Yeah, I'd like to call the committee to order March 11th, Environment Natural Resources Policy. First of all, we need to move the minutes from March 6th. Do I have anyone, Representative Olin, moves the minutes from March 6th? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Today we have several bills to go through, and we are going to be starting off with Representative Mullery, presenting House File 0205. And I will, while you're coming up, I will move that House File 0205 be recommended to pass to the Committee on Government Operations. So, that sound right?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're correct there.
Thank you. And Representative Mullery, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this would bring us to something that was actually started by the federal government has a similar type of act for their agencies, and several states now have it to apply to the state agencies and to take effect on cities in their states. What it would do would require agencies involved in decisions affecting environmental quality to adopt policies that affect environmental justice. Many communities have been targeted for a great amount of pollution, polluting industries, because either they're people of color in the communities or they're low income. For instance, in my district, there's a heavy, very heavy lead problem. And other communities have different types of heavy pollution that came there, usually because businesses decided that was the easiest place to go. And so we're trying to lessen that impact. And so we would have, the task force would be set up to make recommendations, but also cities could file petitions to be subject to that. And if they are disproportionate in the amount of pollution and environmental risks, then the task force would select, and they'd set out criteria and select communities to work with to try and lessen that, and also to reduce any additional impact on them. And we have a member of the Sierra Club here today to testify on this. Mr. Chairman, I know you're short on time. How long did you want the testimony?
You could keep it within 5 minutes. That would be good. So, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to state your name for the record, please, and your position.
I do have a handout. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brett Smith. I'm a volunteer activist with the Sierra Club North Star chapter. I'm a member of the Conservation and Renewable Energy Committee there. I'm also the chapter representative to the Blue Green Alliance. I am retired now. I taught for 10 years in environmental studies at McAllister College, and I've had a long-standing academic and activist interest in the issue of environmental justice. So I'm very pleased to be here today to be able to testify on this bill. Just a little bit of background on the Sierra Club's interest in this issue. Back in 1993, our national board adopted a policy which called upon all parts of the Sierra Club to discuss and explore the linkages between environmental quality and social justice, and to promote dialogue, increased understanding, and appropriate action. That was in 1993, and then in 2001, we adopted a set of resolutions on environmental justice, essentially formulated in the language of rights. And some of those rights that we believe are the rights of all individuals and communities in the country are the right to participate, the right of equal protection, the right to know, the right to sustainable environmental benefits, the right to equity, the right to generational equity, and the rights of Native people. And because of this national policy, I think the Sierra Club is strongly behind the legislation which Representative Mullery has introduced. couple of things about it that I want to try to summarize. Representative Mulley has already indicated what the bill does. I've distributed a fact sheet with a little Sierra Club logo on top. The two main things that I like particularly about this bill are that it commits the state to pursue environmental justice, that is, to eliminate disproportional impacts on communities within the state, whether it be disproportionate because of race or income or ethnic origin. And it commits the state to that particular policy, and then it also sets up a structure in state government to implement and facilitate the achievement of that environmental justice. So there's a commitment, there's also the structure, which includes an advisory task force and an interagency working group. This approach, which is in Representative Mulley's bill, is very similar to the approach taken by the federal government under President Clinton's executive order back in 1994. So those are the basic outlines of the act. Why do we believe this legislation is necessary? I've listed four factors on this fact sheet. One is simply the huge amount of evidence from around the country that in fact disproportional impacts do occur, and that some communities are disadvantaged in terms of their air, their water, the types of facilities that are sited in their areas. And the evidence is pretty overwhelming. Not every study says the same thing, but on balance, it's clear that there's disproportional impact. Second of all, in Minnesota specifically, we have evidence both at the kind of macro level and at the anecdotal or example level that we do have problems with environmental justice in Minnesota. If you want to go to a good source for data, scorecard.org, and there you will see some of the information comparing people of color and whites in terms of cancer risk, Superfund sites, facilities emitting criteria air pollutants, and interestingly enough, if you include both people of color and low income, you get even more of a disproportionate impact. Also in Minnesota, I'm sure you're all aware that there have been particular examples of issues where communities have felt that they were being disproportionately impacted. Some of the examples that have come up recently would include lead contamination in particularly northeast Minneapolis, but in port, homes in general. Excuse me, north Minneapolis. That's your area. Sorry about that. And also issues related to arsenic contamination, mercury contamination in fish. So we do have evidence, and I think what has brought us to an even more urgent position on this is as we move into a new climate change atmosphere where we're beginning to recognize how our environment is changing because of our release of climate change pollutants. And having been a small part of the cap and trade and auction discussion, I know that issues of environmental justice are going to play a large role in that discussion. That is, who is going to be impacted by climate change and who is going to be impacted by the solutions that we come up with. So if we could get this kind of a structure going in state government that would allow for communities that believe they're impacted to have some input, it would be an excellent step forward to moving our total environmental agenda along. Finally, as Representative Mulley mentioned, we're behind the federal government and many states in this issue. The federal government has set up structures like this as far back as 1994. According to the Conference on State Legislatures, as early as 1999, 10 states had adopted environmental justice legislation, and another 15 had introduced such legislation, and several more have passed it since then. In Minnesota, the Pollution Control Agency has adopted a policy on environmental justice. They have committed some staff time to this issue. I think they recognize that it's an important problem, but they are at this point not making it a high priority and have put something equivalent to a half full-time equivalent staff person to work on that. To our knowledge, no other state agencies have adopted such a policy. I could be wrong on the Department of Health. I know that they have done a lot of work on differential health impacts. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony. This is a critical issue for Minnesota at this time, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Are there any questions for Mr. Smith or Representative Mueller at this point? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this question would be for Mr. Smith, but maybe Representative Mueller would want to address it. I support the idea. Just I want to give you all background. There's a Superfund site in Cass Lake, Minnesota that's been listed since 1986, I believe. It's on the Leech Lake Reservation. The Environmental Protection Agency, federal, has been the lead agency since 1996 at the request of the tribe. However, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has been, I think, good stewards in the last few years trying to push the issue. Department of Health has made recommendations. Yet, the site isn't cleaned up. The short-term mitigation plan is vacuuming the carpet and drapes and changing the sod out in front of the houses and telling the kids not to play outside. With a variety of contaminants, the Pike Bay is still polluted. Fish aren't safe to eat, and I guess I would say, you know, if this could help, if this could provide a tool for us to be able to actually gain some ground to clean this up, that would be great. But I need to know. I mean, our state agencies seem to be somewhat engaged now. How is this going to provide us with an additional means to really get at this site, which I think is probably, in my mind, the most egregious example of an environmental injustice in the state of Minnesota. I mean, it's at least as bad as anything else I've heard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mueller, is it
correct?
Well, if the federal government is the problem, I guess this bill would not directly impact that. But I think that by raising the visibility of environmental justice within the state and within the agencies that have to do with these cleanups, it would be likely that more pressure could be put on EPA from the state. And I don't know exactly what role the PCA could play that they're not playing now. But I guess if it's a federal program that's a problem, what we need to do is just raise the visibility and put more pressure at that level. And I think that this bill would provide for avenues for folks to get together and see what we can do about it. Probably not very satisfactory, but that's the best I can do.
Any other questions? Representative Brainard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, I'm wondering, you mentioned that 10 other states have such a task force. Would you have materials that you could share with us on what has happened as a result of those task forces in those states?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryant, I don't have that prepared. One of the things I could do is I could look at those states where the laws have been in effect for the longest and see. I could try to prepare something on that. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith, and I understand there's another testifier. We have Ms. Cecilia Martinez. Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name and for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Cecilia Martinez. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I apologize. I actually just found out about this bill this morning and received numerous emails and requests for me to come and at least put my two cents on behalf of several of our communities in Minnesota. I am a research and consultant. I have a position at the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy out of the University of Delaware. I also am a resident of Minnesota and work on various environmental issues and have worked with a variety of environmental justice communities. The Superfund site at Cass Lake, I also work with the community in Phillips and South Minneapolis around the Superfund site that is the old site of the old pesticide plant in Minneapolis. I think it's very important if you look around the room to see where it is and who it is at the table talking about the issues of environmental pollution and environmental concerns. We know that there is a disproportionate impact, not just in Minnesota, but nationally and especially nationally regarding pollutant contaminants on the health of individuals, children, and families. But we also know that there is a deficit in terms of research capacity, and public participation capacity, particularly among those most vulnerable populations. Those that have low incomes and those do not have the capacity to participate in a public policy process. That does not mean that these communities are not as interested in environmental issues. In fact, most of the research today suggests that despite the fact that there was the old jobs versus environment issue that we've brought up, that many communities of color and low-income communities rate environment and public health as a very high priority in their communities. They just don't seem to have the opportunity to advance their viewpoint and their public stance on these issues. I think legislation like this is a very much needed in Minnesota piece of legislation. It needs to have teeth to it. It needs to have support so that these communities can have access to the same kind of analysis and research that impacts their communities as other communities. And we also need to have representatives who actually represent our communities. Those who are living and who are on a day-to-day basis working in the fields in Cass Lake and in Phillips and in the west side in various areas that where people know what the day-to-day issues of pollution and multiple source pollution are on families. So with that, I would say that many of the community organizations that I work with, from the Indigenous Peoples Task Force to John Minnesota to a whole range of organizations, as well as tribes and Native urban communities, fully support the intent of this type of legislation. We would hope that real outreach is made to those community organizations and to communities, that they can be present at this table to talk to you about what it is that they value, and not simply have other representatives as well representing their interests. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martinez. Any questions at all for Representative Moe has a question.
Ms. Martinez, would you go back to this?
Representative Moe has a question for you.
Thanks. Yeah, great. Ms. Martinez, I appreciate your testimony. You're familiar with the Catholic situation, and I think you could agree that we've had meetings upon meetings, different state, federal, local agencies involved, and right now we've got the Environmental Protection Agency suing the city of Cass Lake for mitigation costs. The city of, you know, who has annual budget is $78,000, suing them for $5 million. It's a true story. And so how is this, I hate to be cynical, but how is another commission, how is another group going to help us? How is this going to give us any leverage to deal with this large force who doesn't really give a rip about Cass Lake or any place else?
I think that's a very legitimate question, and that's why I say I think this is only a first step. I think what we really need is the resource capacity and analysis capacity in order to provide Cass Lake and South Minneapolis and the tribe and the city with the resources to definitely combat and present their own analysis of what the real problem is. Right now, when a fund is designated as a superfund site, the only access to resources and technical assistance is through EPA. So you're kind of stuck in that whole process. And so we need ways in which we can have alternative avenues for the public to be able to define what they see as the problem, to develop the capacity to research the problem, and to provide legal expertise for that problem. I don't know that this particular legislation does that fully, but at least it puts together a body that can begin to articulate an agenda and identify resources that can lead to that. And it's just a beginning point. I completely agree with you. We're in a situation now where the health and viability, particularly in Superfund areas, there's been a recent report looking at Superfund sites and the impact on environmental justice communities, and the report is not pretty. It very clearly states that there is inadequate enforcement, there's disproportionate enforcement among environmental justice communities, and so if we rely on EPA to do that, we're not going to get anywhere.
Martinez, and I agree. I mean, I think one of the important factors in this legislation is to give a voice to those who wouldn't otherwise have it. And I know the first time this issue was really raised to my attention was when I was reading about the development of the interstate highway system and learned that the interstate highway, you can kind of find out where all the low-income areas were in the city based on where the interstate highway was placed. So I think that's a perfect example of people, again, not having really a voice and not being organized and not being able to, you know, raise concerns about how such a thing would affect their communities. Thank you for coming. Is there any are there any other questions for Ms. Martinez or Representative Mullery? Okay, seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
And I don't know if there's any other testifiers.
No.
No? Okay, and Representative Mullery, do you have any final statements? Okay. So, well, I will then renew the motion at House File 0205. Be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Mullery. And Representative Lash. Sure. Any opposition? Any
proponents?
Okay.
Some testifiers.
Just you, Ray.
Any proponents would like to come forward and take the seat next to Representative Lash.
Well, already then.
How about opponents? No. Representative Lash, I will move House File 2746. You recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Mr. Chairman, to start off, I've spoken with Chair Atkins in Commerce, who we discussed Representative Simpson's had some questions about this as well, who, of course, people are aware that Representative Simpson is a grocer in his city and was wondering how this would affect him. And obviously, I told him I've worked with the grocers already who I think are going to come up here and express how they feel about it. And they're very nice people to work with, by the way. And so Representative Simpson and I are going to have a discussion about this in terms of how we can make sure that it's a reasonable proposal. For members, the proposal is to require the recycling of plastic bags. Minnesotans use approximately 2.8 billion plastic bags every year, creating over 21,000 tons of unnecessary waste in our landfills. Now, you may look surprised at that number, but it's a real number because when I went and looked, New York City banned plastic bags, or when they regulated that, I discovered that it impacted 86 billion bags every year. New York City, being on the ocean, of course, understands that these plastic bags have impact on a larger scale, and it's more evident. There are stories that come in from around the world of whales being washed up on beaches with giant plugs of plastic bags in their stomach, and they starve to death because they can't consume any more food. That's happened in Australia, France, as well as twice off the coast of Africa, where the determination afterwards, the medical examination determined the cause of death was plastic bags. There's also a giant swirl in the Pacific Ocean off the coast. People are probably aware, off the coast of California, where there is essentially a garbage island, which you can't actually walk on, but it's made up of a large number of photodegraded plastic chips from plastic bags and plastic bottles that all swirl in one particular location due to the prevailing winds, kind of like you see the foam in a sink all congregate in the middle of the swirl as it goes down the drain. Same thing happens in the Pacific Ocean. And members, this is happening in Minnesota too. It's more difficult to see, however. And so this is an effort to get on the front end of recycling and how we can alleviate this problem. China has also issued a directive regarding plastic bags. The Chinese were using up to 3 billion plastic bags daily. That obviously has a huge impact, but China's already getting on in front of this, and I suspect we should as well. The proposal for Minnesota is just to require that there be a program that already exists in many major supermarkets in the metro area, but that essentially does five things. The recycling program applies to stores of over 5,000 square feet of retail or a store that is part of a chain of stores. So we're looking at the big players here who can afford to get into it. Number one, you have to have on the outside of the bag, please reuse or recycle at a participating store on the bag. Second, there needs to be a bin for collection of plastic carry-out bags at the location. Third, all bags need to be returned to the store, must be collected, transported, and recycled from the store. Fourth, the plastic carry-out bags and other film cannot be disposed of in any solid waste disposal facility. And finally, the operator of the store has to make available to consumers reusable bags that you see in many of these other store locations. So it's not an all-out ban, but it's saying that if we're going to use them, we got to make sure that they responsibly recycle them. I was reminded by many people when I proposed this of that scene in the movie American Beauty, which won several Academy Awards, of that plastic bag swirling in a garbage tornado. And I walk through that same thing every day when I work at the St. Paul City Attorney's Office in City Hall. There's a garbage tornado that collects three or four of these things, and I have to fend them off with an umbrella or other kind of sticker object, which would save me some consternation in the future. But members, I'm sure there were some other things that I was going to say on this that I was going to leave to the testifiers, which I don't have right now. I would just leave you members with the statement that we will be working with people who have concerns about this in the future. Finally, I did get this bill from a friend of mine in California where it was enacted, and it works really well. And when I asked the grocers about it, they stated that the reason it works well in California was that every store that they know about there has a recycling facility nearby. And in Minnesota, that may not necessarily be the case. I think that's something that we need to get at. And this bill can be one step in the direction of moving forward on that. So I would urge your support to move on to one of the many other stops this bill has in committee members.
Representative Lesh, are there any questions for Representative Lesh? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, when we're looking at this, it seems sort of punitive to the grocers. I mean, if I'm not to use an example, but say a grocer from sort of a north central Minnesota city running a couple little grocery stores who shall remain nameless, and I have this program in place, where do I take all these? What do I do with all of the? I mean, it just seems like it's a kind of an unnecessary burden on the grocer.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, number one, if you were in that situation, the bill wouldn't impact you because your stores have to be either over 5,000 square feet or you have to be part of a chain of stores. Okay. However, if you do have five stores or are over at one store over 5,000 square feet, in that case, then that is going to be the subject of further discussion we have on this bill, Representative Hoppe, because it is one of those situations where there, some people of their own volition drive them to a major area. I know that Duluth and St. Cloud are beginning to move towards this where they have facilities where they can do that. I'm not interested in forcing these small operators to use their Saturdays to pack up their truck full of plastic bags and ship them off to the Twin Cities. That's not what I'm aiming for. And we're going to work together on that in the future.
And Representative Olin, the question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was basically the same type question on the, if you're in northern Minnesota, there's not necessarily a concrete way to handle plastic bags anywhere near. So what would a store that fits this description do with the plastic bags if they were to get them?
Okay,
well, I could, Mr. Chair, I could give the same answer, or I could continue on the previous answer and say that there are two ways to address that. One is by geography, which it would be unfortunate because rural areas, they're going to have plastic bags swirling around in their towns. or address it via a square footage of the store to maybe cut down on the number of stores it affects initially. Those are going to be things we're going to be looking at.
Some of that's got to be looked at, because I can think of some stores that might be at that size that I don't know if they have a good way to get rid of them.
I know you were saying, or it has to be a chain, and what would be the definition of a chain? You're mentioning somebody that has two stores. It would have to be, is there a certain number?
Yes, Mr. Chair, definition of chain is line 1.9, five or more stores located in the state.
Okay, thank you. Representative Taylor had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, a number of my comment was really about this, the chain of stores, and I'm not even sure that five is a good number, but since you have indicated in your answers to the last two questioners on this regard that you're going to continue working on it, that is a good thing, because I think that you might even want to consider the seven county metro area definition rather than expanding out into a chain of five or more. Although I know that in some parts of outstate Minnesota, it's already working with some of the larger chains. And I'm just not sure that, you know, five or more is the right number. But I definitely think that the square footage is not, you know, going to be a very viable or helpful parameter on this. But certainly the number of stores and the availability they might have for a backhaul, which is presumably how they would be dealing with this if they have their own trucks and doing a backhaul. But I think, you know, it's, as you said, needs some work on it at the end of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, I was just thinking of the practicality of this. You know, going to the grocery store, I don't even remember to bring my grocery list. And you know, you're taking the bags home, so you have all these bags at home. Would it make more sense for us to throw it on the blue recycle bin and have the recycle truck come and pick it up instead of bringing it back to the grocery store?
Representative Lash.
Sure, Representative Tao, what you're describing is a system that essentially we already have in place. At least I know in my county we do. And if your proposal is just more education, well, that's one option, of course. But other nations around the world are moving well ahead of this. Well ahead of us on this, and I think we need to get with the program. Representative Tao, you're a hunter. I know you appreciate outdoors and wildlife and conservation issues, and the reason I originally got this idea was several hunters in my district were just sick of tossing their lines out and fishermen, anglers, tossing their lines out and getting plastic bags back on a couple of occasions. And they said, can you do something about this? And then I heard from the plant out in California, it seemed to be working really well, so I tried to explore that. I think the home option is definitely an option. Education can help. Use your blue bins. But until it's stressed at the point of purchase, it's just not going to resonate with people because it's too easy to just throw them away in the regular way.
Representative Arginius.
Thank you. As people are suggesting advice, I'll just add another piece to the table. I went to the Mississippi Market, which is nearby here, in the last week, and I got to the checkout, and the woman said to me, paper or plastic? And then she said, oops, I forgot, we don't do plastic anymore. And perhaps one of the ways to address some of these is to give an option for folks who do not have plastic carry-out bags, which seem to be the worst offenders here, that they would not fall under this, particularly the smaller store. The Mississippi Market is a smaller store and was perfectly comfortable in just offering me paper or carry or my own bag.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, you mentioned California and New York. Is there any other states that are taking any action on this, or the federal government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, the information that I have is mostly municipalities at this point. New York is by far the largest American city to enact it, but like I said, they use $86 billion other cities in the world, Melbourne, Australia, San Francisco was the first city in North America, and they did an outright ban of non-recyclable and non-biodegradable bags made from petroleum products. Other nations throughout the world are doing it. As far as the United States, I can look that up and get back to you. That was information that I would have anticipated that my helpful testifier here would have provided.
I just want to make it clear, is it cities that are doing it? When you say nations, do you mean cities in different nations, or do you mean whole countries? And are the whole states that are doing this, or is it just cities in California?
To my knowledge, well, the entire state of California has done it, and in terms of other states that have done it, I'll have to get back to
that. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative West, I just have a few questions. Do you know, I mean, currently the way we do it at my house is we put all the bags in the cupboard, and then once every week or two I seem to squish them up and to kind of challenge myself to see how small I can make these hundreds of bags. And then I take them back to any of the grocery stores in Hastings, and they got a box of them, and I drop them in there. I don't really know what happened from that point. Do you know what percentage of the plastic bags today are recycled? And then I am a little bit dumbfounded. I don't know myself, and maybe if you don't, I got a feeling one of the other committee members may know. How valuable are they in the recycling benefit? How efficient of a recycling process is plastic? I would think being all petroleum, there must be some value there. I guess I'll start with those questions.
I can, and Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, obviously there's a testimony here that can speak to most of that, but I can say, first of all, that if we brought this legislation 15 years ago, there would have been a hue and cry against it. Since then, though, many in the metro area stores have voluntarily done this, because obviously when you have access to recycling facilities, you can do it. So retailers have led the way in for them being able to recycle already in the metro area, which is why you have the opportunity to do it down in Hastings. But in terms of the use of it and amount, I'll let the testify here.
Justin, if you could state your name for the record.
I'm Wayne Judy with the Minnesota Post Control Agency. I'm the State Market Development Coordinator. As to the value of the material, if you look at generally it costs about 5 cents a pound or $100 a ton to boil this material. If you throw in some trucking and transportation, you have another $100 a ton, so you're up to $200 a ton. Current market value is anywhere between $320 a ton and $460 a ton as it goes. In terms of the recycling rate, we have, if you include Merrick, there are others, but Merrick is a little bit over a million pounds. If you look at our waste composition study in terms of the amount of film in the waste stream, you're probably looking at 80 to 100,000 tons. Now, this includes stretch film, pellet wrap, and other things, so you can calculate that in terms of it's fairly low at the moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Jury, I always know on recycling, a lot of people don't know whether the demand is there either. Can you typify or explain who uses it and how bad do they want it?
Yes, Representative Gardner. Chair. We have two large markets. These are both out of state. One is Trex Lumber, which you may have used. The other is AERT, which is Trex Decking Market to Lowe's. I get calls weekly in terms of do you have more material. They're always looking for material. It is in demand. Locally, we have Up North Plastics, which takes a very pure stream. They make film and other salvage bags. And we also have capacity coming online in Shakopee, Advanced Granulating Systems, Inc., which will wash, pelletize, and grind, wash, and pelletize that plastic for the end market. So the end markets are very strong. probably the strongest they've been in the last 15 years.
Representative Gardner.
So what I'm gathering is that there is value for the material, there is a desire for it, and you could actually bring in some revenue for it.
Yeah, there are positives on the revenue side. Yes, sir.
And yet there are areas underserved in the state.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess one of the comments in following in the line of the constructive comments people have been making is, I think, Representative Lesh, you should take a look at the 5,000 square feet. I mean, that's not very big. I don't know how big this room is. It's, I don't know, 500 square feet. But that seems to me like not a very big store. And the other thing is there a, have you requested a fiscal note on this?
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, yes. There is one, but there's been one requested. Yeah.
Okay, we're not a finance committee, so we don't know about things like that. But I was just wondering for down the road.
Sure. Representative Olin.
Yes. Do you know of any sources up outside of the Twin Cities area, like in northern Minnesota?
Sources of
to be able to sell plastic.
Well, if you look at any recyclables, Representative Bowen, it's pretty much the same as any commodity. If you can get a truckload of the material, both Trex and Choice Decking are, Trex is located in Virginia and Virginia, the state of Virginia, and Choice is located in Arkansas. So there are the economics, if you can get a truckload of this material, they are there. The market will buy it.
Representative Moe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment to Representative Owen's question. Magnuson Trucking, which has the contract for Beltrami County for all the recycling waste removal, they try to market everything that they can. And any time that there's something that the market actually allows for them to sell recycling, they make an effort to collect it and sell it. But it's very difficult. And plastics, they're down to just ones and twos and only closed containers. Otherwise, everything else, the county taxpayer has to eat a significant amount of money. So I'm sure there's a market down in the metro. We're talking from Bemidji, 4 hours to get there. So transportation costs, then where it's profitable to collect down here, or at least even a wash. For the company that our county has a contract with, it's not. Otherwise, they would do it. I mean, they're very frugal business people, and they want to try to recycle everything possible because they can reduce the tax burden for us. They will.
Yeah, just a quick follow-up comment. Actually, I agree with the philosophy that we should be doing this, but Representative Moe gets exactly what I'm getting at. You're 5 miles. I'm another hour and a half further north than he is.
That's Canada.
All of a sudden, you're losing tons of money trying to
That's why we have the requirements of 5,000 square feet of chain of stores in there. And as Representative Hoppe pointed out, that is going to be a topic of discussion when I speak with Representative Simpson and others on this. The idea is that we have the big players get into this first. That's the only thing that's going to create a market for this, if there is one. And as has been stated, there definitely is a market for it. So if you can spur that and make sure that there are commodities going in both directions on these trucks, it makes it profitable for these trucking companies to make it happen. Now, it still may not at 4 hours, but as we see St. Cloud and Duluth getting into this, then suddenly it starts to be realistic profitably.
Maybe one way to address this issue as far as the access to recycling facilities is to have it within a certain number of miles of a recycling facility. That's an amendment that might be something you would consider.
I think it would, Mr. Chair and members, but I would ask you, considering the number of stops that we have after this committee, I would ask that if you think it's generally a good idea to pass the bill as is and let me get it through and work out the details with people after this. There are several more committees for it to meet on. I just haven't had a chance to have the discussion with Representative Simpson yet. And I can assure the committee that, it's not, this is not going to be where it's going to get out with the language as is. It just needs to be worked on.
Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch, as much as I like the idea of the recycling, it was what I thought from what, I think it's Mr. Jerry, is that right?
Sure.
Thank you. The bags are of economic value, and I think that's why stores that can are already doing it. The grocery stores that it makes sense for them to do, it's of value when they collect them at our local grocery stores. And I actually think, Representative Mullen, Representative Owen, I think some of the stores up north do collect them. I don't want to say for sure, but I thought our grocery store up where our cabin is, I think has a collection. So I'm thinking some of the big grocery stores, because I just put a pencil to it, the economics are such that there's probably somebody figured it out that they can collect these bags and make money doing it. I'm not sure that we need to legislate as much as we should be educating people of how easy it is to keep it and how effective it does work. I just don't know that this is something that's necessary at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative McNamara, in general, I think it's okay to let the market solve problems. And there's no question that education is going to be a big piece of this. You just mandate something with no educational component, it's probably not going to solve the problem. But I don't think necessarily the economics or profitability of this is going to clean up a plastic garbage island in the Pacific Ocean or plugs in a whale's stomach or the things that we're starting to see to wildlife around Minnesota. And I think there's something to be said for encouraging legislatively this to happen above and beyond what the market is already willing to do. I'm just saying that I agree. I don't want it to be too onerous initially, which is why I'm willing to work with the grocers and others.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lesch, I know you're going to work with Representative Simpson and the grocers. And following up on a number of other comments, I have to say this. I have a friend who owns a number of grocery stores, not in Metro, some are in larger areas, but in a lot of different cities. And I know he is an environmentalist. He doesn't want to be polluting. He wants to recycle whatever he can. And he wants to do things that make good economic sense. But these guys are struggling to keep, any time that a Walmart or anyone else opens up in one of the stores or one of their cities, they got a lot of competition already. They got all kinds of other competition with people that can drive to other places to get things. And I think, I mean, we don't want to be piling on, and to use your words, to make this too onerous. And I think we're running the risk of doing that and making it even harder for people to stay in business. And I particularly would look at Subdivision 4, the penalties, and I think, you know, we're making it harder on all of these guys to do business, these men and women, and then you're looking at, if somebody doesn't comply with this correctly, not only are they having to spend more money to do this, they're looking at some fairly substantial penalties.
Chair, Representative Hoppe, that came out in the Senate, so...
Say no more.
They solve your problem.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, and we do have a couple of people that want to testify. Mr. Guelas from the Minnesota Chamber. Welcome, if you could state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I sit before you today representing the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, specifically more. We have an affiliate at the Chamber of Commerce called Minnesota Wastewise, and I just wanted to make you very briefly aware of a program because I know time is short and there's a long agenda and you've got a floor session. Minnesota Wastewise has a program called It's in the Bag. If you want, when you go over to floor session today, it'll probably be quick, but it's inthebag.org. It started in 2003 of October. Last year, the program, so far totally, the program has recycled 325 million pounds of plastic bags, and last year alone was 1.1 million bags were recycled. It's a public-private partnership between the Chamber of Commerce, a voluntary program set up between the Chamber of Commerce and Wastewise, Hennepin County, American Plastics Council, the old OEA, PCA, Merrick Company. You've heard Merrick is a company in Badges Heights, I think, might be in Representative Scalzi's district. And tracked along with the Pioneer Press and Star Tribune. And it is a voluntary program that, if you've seen them sometimes in the metropolitan area, Rainbow Cubs, there is, it's in the bag. And Representative McNamara had referenced it. I take mine in my old football hand warmer mufflers, and I try to see how many I can stuff in there and then bring them back when I can. But it's a voluntary program. They set up, there's a company called Merrick that is set up in Badness Heights. They collect them. They employ over 300 adults that come in. They sort them. And then it's used for, and then as Wayne mentioned, it's used by Trek. That's, they make decking, and I think, not sure if Mel Gullickson up at Hired Hands in Deer River still does some of that stuff, because they used it up there, some of the plastic recycling. It might not have been the bag, but they made picnic benches. I know they were dealing with the DNR, bought some of the picnic benches from them. So I just wanted to make you aware of it, that it is, Jamie from the grocers can elaborate on it a little bit more, but we, it's here in the metropolitan area. It's a little tougher when you're in Twin Valley. It's a little tougher when you're in Northome, or you're in Good Thunder, or you're in Solway, or Bena. It's a little bit tougher to kind of do that. The economics of it just don't work. But we've got this program in the cities I just want to make you aware of in the metropolitan area. I think there's probably a couple of the larger stores that are up north that were, and we love the goals that Representative West has brought forward. We're willing to work with him. I think it's been mentioned a couple of times that the big thing is going to be education. We can lead the horse to water, but you can't always make him drink, and we're willing to be a part of that conversation. We look forward to working with Representative Lesh as this moves forward. I'm going to let Jamie and Mr. Anderson
Representative Lesh has a question.
Yes, thank you. Committee, we like to talk about outcomes, and so we heard from Representative Lesh how many plastic bags are in circulating in Minnesota. Do you know either the number or the percentage that you actually collect?
I don't. I can get those numbers for you, because I think part of, and Wayne might be able to elaborate a little bit further, part of the one of the grants that we've get, along with the voluntary donations from the people that are members of WasteWise, I think we are required to report to PCA. And like I said, I know that Mark Blazer, who is our executive director of WasteWise, gave me the numbers of 3.25 million total and 1.1 last year. But do you mean in terms of individual bags?
Well, I think what we need to understand is there is this aggregate out there, and you can measure it in several ways. What percentage of that aggregate are we taking out with your program? Is it 2%? Is it 10%? What's your ultimate outcome? So I think we need to understand what this really is.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucinius, I will work with Mr. Blazer and the PCA to try and get you that percentage.
Mr. Quillis and Mr. Anderson, did you want to come forward as well? State your name for the record, please.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jamie Poole, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association. The Minnesota Grocers Association is a trade association representing the food retail industry since 1897. We have over 200 retail members with nearly 1,200 stores statewide and approximately 115 distributors and manufacturers. Our member companies employ over 85,000 union and non-union Minnesotans. When dealing with environmental legislation, it's important to ask, what is our desired result and how do we get there together? Grocers, retailers, waste haulers, government, consumers must all work together to create viable and easy ways to encourage recycling. Consumers' wants, needs, and demands drive the business community of grocers and retailers. We listen and have responded by voluntarily offering plastic bag recycling programs. As Tony told you, one of the programs, the innovative It's in the Bag, was created in October of 2003 by local companies in partnership with the Chamber of Commerce and WasteWise. This program is unique to Minnesota and voluntarily is funded by over 130 stores. This program collects plastics, grocery bags, retail bags, newspaper bags, dry cleaning bags, and any other type of plastic film. at local grocery and retail stores. And I think that's also key to note is that this is all plastic film. This is the stuff coming from your newspapers, dry cleaners. It's not just shopping bags. Collection is done by MARIC, who is a local nonprofit organization employing disabled Minnesotans. Last year, this program recycled 1.1 million pounds of plastic. There are several other programs throughout the state where suppliers voluntarily collect, recycle, and recycle plastics. Additionally, MCU has worked with partners in Duluth, St. Cloud, and Carver County to start programs similar to MARIC. An independent rural grocer with a green heart offers plastic bag recycling and personally makes a 3-hour round trip to drop those bags at MARIC. We feel that mandating what we are already working on and is being done effectively where street infrastructure allows is not the answer to successful weight reduction. One of our specific concerns with the bill stems from the lack of rural recycling programs for these materials. Once a grocer or retailer in a rural area collects the material, it's highly possible that they do not have the necessary support to complete the recycling process. Fines and penalties on these retailers will not solve the infrastructure problem. Additionally, we know from testimony in the Senate that curbside bag recycling is not a viable option and is not, at this time, offered anywhere in the state. So you can't just put your plastic bags at curbside, and I think that's another area we need to work together to resolve. Grocers have voluntarily borne the cost of their current recycling programs. We do belong to the WasteWise program, and we pay a fee to have those bags picked up. We don't collect the revenues back that's given back to MARIC. These are, have been successful in removing plastics from the solid waste. Again, we feel it's not necessary to require additional record-keeping for what we do voluntarily. These record-keeping requirements would create additional costs, be labor-intensive, and difficult to track. We don't have the means to weigh waste in our stores, nor the additional staff that's required. In some stores, plastic is removed by their distribution and taken out of state, so again, that would be very difficult to record keep. From an environmental standpoint, creating logs in thousands of stores throughout the state also seems counterproductive. The Minnesota Grocers Association believes educating consumers is a critical step in achieving tangible waste results. In that vein, we have applied for a grant from the PCA to start a public awareness campaign that encourages reuse in order to cut down on plastics in the waste stream. This public service campaign would include opportunities for all retailers throughout Minnesota. At the end of the day, sustainability is a shared responsibility between business, government, and consumers. In closing, we do not believe the mandate is necessary, and we believe that all merchants who offer plastic bags can work together to find a thoughtful and feasible, easy solution. The entire retail community cares deeply about its consumers and its environment. We want to leave Minnesota a little cleaner than we found it. And we too welcome the opportunity to work with Representative Lesh to make this more feasible, but again, a mandate we feel at this juncture isn't necessary. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, and Representative Gardner.
Have
a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a comment, and maybe Mr. Anderson and Mr. Quiles had one comment too, but when I worked in recycling, if you're not in the field, I noticed that people do what they're good at, you know, and grocers and retailers are good at retailing, and they're good at distributing stuff, and they're good at marketing and responding to customer needs, and that's good. You know, when the voluntary effort went through, there had to be a lot of some technical assistance. You know, someone from WasteWise would come out and say, "Oh, here's your, you got a baler. Okay, you can stack the stuff in here, or we have a nonprofit that'll come pick it up." It sort of fits outside the box of what the retailer's used to, and so I can understand why maybe not a lot of stores or other places have actually done stuff voluntarily. And it does sort of take some concentrated effort for someone to just say, "Yes, we can do it." So let's just assume for the moment that Representative Less's bill sails through the House, but it doesn't go anywhere in the Senate, and you know, it doesn't get passed in law or anything. Would you consider working with the chamber and the retailers together on something like a best management practices thing, so that through your own association, through WasteWise, you can actually have that concentrated effort where you can send your waste audit person to Bemidji, for example, and go to all the retailers and say, "You know what, we can get a truckload quantity every 2 weeks and market it or what have you." Because that's not what you know how to do, you don't know how to go about it. So, would you be able to do that?
Ms. Poole?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, that is something, again, we actually had applied for another grant in partnership with WasteWise to try and create more avenues to get those bags in and get them recycled and find collective areas where we could do that. And I think that's the thoughtful process that we do need to sort out and really create ways that this can be done, because it is critical to our Earth, and I don't think any of us disagree with that. So I think that's a very feasible and excellent approach.
And Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. I have two different kinds of questions. One is, in your voluntary effort, what is your what percentage outcome do you intend to get out of the waste stream?
School.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Venus, I don't know that we have a tangible number, and I think that's a little difficult to come up with, but I think we could go back and try and obtain something. I think some goals for, you know, set for us to achieve would be good. It's a little difficult because the bags we're putting out into the system are not necessarily the bags we're taking back in, because we are bringing in dry cleaner, you know, other types of plastic, but I think that that's a valid, I mean, that is something we would need to address.
I think if we don't have any outcomes, we don't know what we're doing. I mean, there are ways to measure without counting every bag. It's just how much it's in and out, and we can do it roughly. The second thing is, the grocers, along with Office of Environmental Assistance, about 10 or 15 years ago, did a education program in the grocery stores, and it was a total flop. There was no outcome from it. Have you made a projection of what it would really cost to educate consumers without doing something like Representative Lesh is suggesting, putting it on the plastic, you know, putting it on the bag? Have you made an estimate of what it would cost to change behavior to make sure that people recycle?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we've again been working with Pollution Control. They've been doing some study groups to find out what would incentivize people to use reusable bags. It's kind of more of a focus we've been working to get the waste stream out. And I know we've been looking at incentives to offer a nickel back, a dime back to use reusables. And along with that, in the recycling vein, you know, I don't know. We're still trying to figure out how we can get consumers to do that. Our program was through public service, kind of to show them what the bags are doing. Here's your three options. We offer the three options in most all of our stores across the state, and to continue along that vein to try and educate. You know, again, it was a public service campaign through ads, through bag stuffers, and I understand certainly the tangible back on that.
If I could, I mean, I'm hearing something I heard 15 years ago, and it flopped. So I think you do need to have some, figure out, is this really something you can do, educating people without more, because it didn't work then. So, and then just send a whole bunch of money and grants to put up signs in grocery stores and public service announcements. I mean, I'm skeptical.
Any other questions? Comments, Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the retailers, and I thank you and the members for the opportunity to speak today. I apologize to Representative Lesh because I didn't talk to him until today about raising concerns about his bill. So having said that, I thank him for challenging us, because I think this is a good challenge. Having said that, I want you to know that I already do have members that do plastic bag recycling, and they're not the same people that Jamie's talking about. They're members who have actually started their own plastic bag recycling programs and either do it nationally or regionally or locally, and they're very successful at it. In addition to that, I do have members that contribute to it's in the bag program but aren't recycling, but are in the process of developing a recycling program for plastic bags. Why is that? Well, you know, many times consumers are way ahead of us. And you might find that yourself, that sometimes your own constituents are ahead of you. One of the things that stores are pretty good at is picking up what the public pulse is. That's why green initiatives are becoming so popular among retailers. They're talking about building with recycled materials. They're talking about providing energy, well, they are providing Energy Star products to consumers.
They're looking for alternative energy sources. They're putting energy-efficient lighting. They're providing recycling events. You know, before we had our e-waste bill, courtesy of Representative Saylor and Osment, you know, first we're already providing big recycling events, and because and the public was really responding to it big time. So I guess what I'm telling you is our stores understand that green is popular and that there's marketability and profitability in being green. And so they're responding to that in many ways. And so sometimes it's important that we get out of the way and encourage that rather than finding things that might in fact hamper that. Let me talk to you about the fact that one of the reasons that retailers in rural Minnesota often use plastic is because of the very big cost and bulk of paper. It is bulky, it is heavy, it costs more to get to rural destinations. And further, as Jeremy mentioned, there is no infrastructure in rural Minnesota to deal with plastic bag recycling. You know, we're like the representative from Hastings, at our house we gather those bags and we have convenient places to take them to. We can't put them in our recycling, but we've got convenient places to take them to. The bill also requires recycling if you have more than 5 store locations. One of the unintended consequences of this is if you're like Tammy Felipe at Fast Frames in Eagan, who owns only one store but is part of a chain of hundreds around the country, she falls under this bill, and yet she only has 1,400 square feet and literally no place to put recycling, nor the capacity to do that, nor would anybody want to buy a canvas Fast Frame bag. It would just be impractical. And as somebody mentioned, they're trying to deal with all the current regulations that they have as business people, plus this small business person pays almost $5,000 a year on that 1,400 square feet in that small space. The same is true of someone who has one store of Cartridge World. Again, it's a nationwide, worldwide chain of stores, and they would fall under this, but if you only own one store, you still have to provide the recycling. It's really cost prohibitive and really impractical for them to do that. So I don't think that the intent really is to provide additional burden on business, but rather to encourage people and businesses to do more recycling and to offer more green initiatives. I guess my last point is the marketplace is working, and the marketplace will continue to work if you provide it the right incentives, and if consumers have the education, and if there's more infrastructure in place for all of this to happen. There's a great deal that has to be done to supply infrastructure for more of this to happen. The marketplace is doing surprisingly well, and let's see what we can do to encourage it to continue to do that.
Any questions for Mr. Anderson? I see none. Thank you for your testimony. And Representative Lesh, do you have any final comments before we vote?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This appears to be one of those bills where it doesn't come down to basic philosophical opposition. In some cases, you know, for example, I think of Representative Cornish bill, where there is basic philosophical opposition. Everyone here on this one kind of agrees the direction we need to go on this. It's just how we get there and penalties, etc. And I think it's one of those things that would be work with. I think Mr. Anderson's comments regarding an independent franchisor or independent business that shares a common name can easily be addressed by amendment in lines 1.9 through 1.12, which would be my intention to do. I'm not going to try to do it on the fly now, but it's something that I would intend to do before it hits the next committee. But there are obviously other fixes we can do, too, in the meetings that I'm going to have tomorrow. So with that, members, I would just ask your support.
Well, thank you, Representative Lesh, and I appreciate your willingness to work on compromises and a consensus on this. Representative Scalzi has a question.
A quick question. Would you explain again the penalty phase of this as we see it? Is that going to stay in, or did you say it was put in, or it's going to come out, or how does that work?
I don't want to promise right now, Representative Scalzi, Mr. Chair, Representative Scalzi, that it would come out, but it did come out in the Senate already, and I think at the front end of this that those would be substantially curtailed. And in fact, in my initial glance at this, it's based initially on the numbers on a California economic model too, in terms of the profit margins they have out there too. I put it in initially for the purpose of discussion.
I would anticipate that in discussions it would be substantially curtailed if not come out outright. And it's not in the Senate again.
Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, I will then renew my motion that House File 2746 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could we change that motion to not recommend to pass because Representative Lesh did admit that the bill might need some work. Some other folks said that it needs some work, and he promised us to have some amendments to change some of those things. So could we pass along with public recommendations?
That is a possibility. Representative Lesh, do you have any comments on that?
Obviously, I'd like the committee's recommendation, Mr. Chair, but I would like the committee's recommendation, but we're in the committee's
Any further comments at all? And you can certainly move to amend the motion if you so choose.
I would like to move to amend the motion if that's what we have to do, Mr. Chairman, because I think we could have made some amendments here if we were going to recommend it to pass, but as long as we have Representative Lesh's commitment to make those changes, that's good. Let's pass it out of here, but without recommendation. Otherwise, I think we should keep it here, and we'll make some changes to it here.
Okay. Well, we have a motion to amend the motion and to amend it so that it has no recommendation and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Representative Mariani.
A quick question. Obviously, every committee has the right to look at every issue in a bill. I think one of the reasons it's being referred to Commerce and should be referred to Commerce is a number of the reasons I heard concerns about, which are really Commerce issues. It seems to me that for me, as I approach my work in this committee, it's about looking at the environmental issues, impact issues. And so that, for me, reflects the kind of recommendation I want to make. And I certainly empathize with the number of issues that have been raised here. A lot of square footage issues, impact of small businesses. We don't want to do any harm. It seems to me that's an appropriate thing for the Commerce Committee to deal with. So I'm perfectly comfortable passing forward a bill. So from an environmental perspective, I'm fine recommending this. And now you folks in Commerce, deal with these other issues. So, I mean, I'm not going to fight hard here. I mean, I'll do what we want to do, but I just want to put my 2 cents worth in terms of what I think my vote is here on this committee.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Representative Olin, did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I'll make, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, the question I have is if you're going to put penalty provisions in, which you presently have, are we also looking at public safety as a possibility it should be asked?
Mr. Chair, based on the number of committees that this is going to see after this, including public safety, I suspect each one of you is going to see this bill again, so you get another crack at it. Yes.
Any further comments before we vote on the motion?
I want to repeat the motion so we know what we're
doing. Representative Hackbarth moves that the motion be amended to not recommend or to have no recommendation as far as passing and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. We'll renew the motion that the bill be recommended or referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor without recommendation. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to go or you want to wait? I think we'll be quick.
Okay, Representative Moe has a bill that is not supposed to be controversial, so hopefully we can get that done quickly, and we do have to recess at 5:30.
Yeah,
so this will be the last bill before we recess.
Whatever works for you.
We're coming back tonight?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 3685. pass and be referred to the general.
Representative Moe moves that House File 3685 be recommended pass and be referred to the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is an example of a bill that was brought to me by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency because they are trying to do the right thing. The Environmental Pollution Agency, I mean the Environmental Protection Agency, has actually changed the requirements, reporting requirements for has changed the reporting requirements for the release of toxic chemicals, essentially permitting a bunch of significant amount of additional pollution before reporting would be required. They changed that rule in 2006. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency would like to go back to the previous quantity of pollution required to require that form to be used prior to the EPA's ruling, going back to 500 pounds as opposed to the new rule that the EPA passed requiring the reporting only up to 5,000 pounds. I think in this case, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency wants to do the right thing to continue to protect our environment, and we should be encouraging them to do so and glad that they'd like to. So with that, Scott, Steve Giddings, who I've just met 30 seconds ago, will.
Not your good friend, Steve?
But he's my evil.
Well, I don't know what to say after that one. Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
State your name for the record.
My name is Stephen Giddings from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and we appreciate the opportunity to talk with you this evening. The toxic release inventory, as Representative Moe mentioned, the threshold for reporting was changed on December 18th of 2006 by the U.S. EPA. And basically what this bill is trying to do is to basically restore the TRI reporting to the level that has been in place since 1990 and to basically get back to the way we were doing it before. TRI reporting is required for a lot of different types of facilities for different types of chemicals that basically fall into two classifications, what are called PBT chemicals, which are persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic chemicals, as well as non-PBD chemicals. PBD chemicals that you might find commonly would be mercury, lead, things such as that. The non-PBT chemicals would be things such as halogenated solvents, acids, bases, things such as that. As Representative Moe said, EPA has, in effect, raised the threshold quite a bit from 500 pounds per year to 2,000 pounds per year. And this was done despite our advice and the advice of several other states to EPA that we did not think that this was appropriate. And because of this, Minnesota has joined with 11 other states in filing a lawsuit against EPA about raising the threshold levels. We did this because our concern about the loss of toxic release data in two different areas. One, the public community right to know, so that information for certain facilities would not be as readily available. And also number two, we assess pollution prevention fees based on some of the reporting that comes in. The money that we receive for pollution prevention fees help go to fund such programs as the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program, which helps a wide variety of different businesses on pollution prevention, as well as the Retired Engineers Technical Assistance Program, which recently worked with the State Office Building and House staff on measures they could take with regards to energy efficiency, recycling, paper use, and other things. In our discussions with the TRI reporters, again, they've been used to reporting in the manner that's being proposed by the bill since 1990, so it's not a major change from that, and there were no major issues seen by the TRI reporters, including getting support from both the Chamber and also the American Chemical Association. Something also worth noting is when EPA changed the reporting thresholds, it resulted in a loss of revenue to the Pollution Control Agency of $43,000. Again, that's used primarily for MNTAP work or RETAP work, as well as a loss of $29,000 to public safety with regards to homeland security. Again, simply stated, what this bill is trying to do is to restore the thresholds back to where they were prior to December 18th, 2006, to make that data more available to the PCA and to the community in general.
Okay, Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, to boil it down, the feds relaxed the reporting requirements, and you want them to be more stringent where they were before because you're protecting our health and so on and so forth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, that's exactly it.
Okay. That's all we need to know.
Okay. Right. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Moe, would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Moe renews his motion that House File 3685 be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
So it's passed. And we will recess until the call of the chair. Dean Poppy, I'd like to call the meeting back to order again. And we have Representative Poppy here to present her bill. We are going to be taking up House File 3643. And I will move House File 3643 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. So, and Representative Poppy to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have an amendment, if you could ask the amendment as well.
Okay. Everybody has the amendment. That would be the H3643DE1
yes,
amendment.
Thank you.
And I will move the author's amendment. Discussion on it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is amended, and Representative Poppy to the bill as amended.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Last session, I brought legislation to this committee that directed the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to pull together stakeholders with licensing issues surrounding individual sewage treatment systems. That legislation passed and was signed into law. This task force met about a half dozen times over the past summer, fall, and winter. The MPCA report was due back to the legislature on February 15th. I believe that the report has been delivered, and if not, it should have been by February 15th or recently. The same folks that brought the bill before me last year to me have also asked me to carry and introduce this legislation this year that would clarify the ISPS licensing problems once and for all and correct those. House File 3643, as amended, will clarify the licensing requirements for professionals working with subsurface sewage treatment systems in Minnesota. It will clarify who is licensed to work on small and medium-sized on-site wastewater treatment systems. These systems are used to treat and safely recycle wastewater from individual residences and small groups of homes and or businesses in areas not served by large centralized wastewater treatment plants. The Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, MOWA, is represented here today. They will help to testify as to why it is important to support this legislation. First, I'll introduce Eric Larson.
Mr. Larson, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Larson. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify. Again, my name is Eric Larson. I am here representing the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, MOWA, we refer to ourselves as. It's a nonprofit trade association dedicated to education and professionalism among septic professionals. My company, Septic Check Incorporated, we're based in Malacca. We have built our business designing, installing, and operating specialized septic systems for difficult sites such as lake lots with restricted space, churches, church camps and resorts with widely fluctuating flows, and high-strength kitchen waste for rural businesses. Our industry has moved ahead, searching out innovative technologies to tackle these issues and protect the groundwater. These engineered technologies include advanced aerobic treatment, membrane treatment, sand and peat filters, fabric trickling filters, time growth control panels to manage flow, and remote sensing for distant operation. We are part of a new generation of septic professionals. Do we work with soil scientists? Do we work with engineers? Yes, quite commonly. since 1996, law and rule have allowed us to design systems up to 10,000 gallons per day. Our university extension has trained us. Our trade organization, which includes county regulators, extension educators, independent business people, manufacturers, and engineers, have partnered with and supported the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the University of Minnesota Extension in developing this industry. I have served on state and national committees to develop standards and methods for design, maintenance, installation, and operation of such systems. We and others have built businesses around this work as allowed by law and created this industry. We agree that new advanced training and licensing is important and that soil scientists and engineers need to be utilized in some circumstances. Now, however, engineers within the PCA intend to require engineers on all systems over 5,000 gallons per day and on most down to 2,500 gallons per day, regardless of their simplicity. Let me be very clear that this market has always been open to the engineering community. They now want to have it exclusively theirs. I and others volunteered to serve on the committee that you, the legislature, instructed PCA to form. We received the PCA draft report of the committee's work and wrote an extensive dissent to it. The agency recommendation does not reflect the consensus agreed to by the committee. The PCA will tell you that Iowa requires engineers at 1,500 gallons. The engineers will tell you that these systems are so complex and difficult that we can't understand them. What separates Minnesota from almost all the other states is the depth and quality of our university training program. They have over 30 years of experience training in this field. And whether they know it or not, the agency has marginalized the UU's nationally recognized program and marginalized people in the agency who do know the science of septic systems. So what has brought us to this point? Why are we here today? What is this really all about? For the engineers, it is about license protection, turf. The fear is that if they do not defend their licenses here, they will be chipped away at somewhere else as well. For the agency, a reorganization a few years ago moved the septic program to the Municipal Wastewater Division. The good people that run this division are trained to send millions of gallons of water per day through a treatment plant. They now have authority over soil-based treatment systems. The big pipe is not the same as the careful loading rates required for soil-based systems. An illustration of this point is the extremely high rate of failure of engineered soil-based systems that were publicly funded through rural development for unsued communities. Through the legislature, have had to provide millions of public dollars to re-engineer and repair these engineered systems. The agency would now have these same firms required to engineer a system for a mom-and-pop resort that generates 5,000 gallons per day. My business is growing. We provide living wage jobs in rural Minnesota, and we protect our lakes, rivers, and drinking water. We provide economical solutions for treating wastewater in our communities. We stand by our product. The needs of our customers are urgent, and today we do not know that we can do this work beyond 2010. MAWA's goal from day one has been to have the right people with the right skills, qualifications, and authorizations doing the work of designing, building, operating, and maintaining the small and mid-sized wastewater treatment systems that are needed to provide cost-effective protection of human health and the environment in Minnesota. We need your help. You direct the MPCA. Please support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. Any questions for Mr. Larson or Representative Poppy?
We have one other testifier.
Okay. Seeing no questions for Mr. Larson, we'll call the next testifier.
Mr. Jefferson.
Welcome, Mr. Jasperson, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ronald Jasperson. I own a Wilmer Precast Company out in Wilmer, Minnesota. We supply concrete septic tanks and advanced treatment products to the on-site industry. I hold a designer's license under the 115 license, specifically to assist designers in applying the advanced technology and review of their designs for product that we sell to them. I served on a stakeholders group as an alternate to the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association. The agency's recommendation will not enhance the protection of the environment or public health. It will unnecessarily complicate the design and permit process, as well as have a major economic impact on rural Minnesota. Just a couple of recently constructed projects were on-site design build firms licensed by MS 115-56 were allowed to compete with the board licensed professional designers for systems over 5,000 and under 10,000 gallons per day demonstrate the difference in design concepts and approaches. In 2003, a church camp called Camp Anania was told to bring their waste treatment into compliance. The local unit of government told them that it was a large project, so they will likely need a professional engineer. The construction estimate was between $500,000 and $700,000. As the camp talked about closing, a local on-site design build firm calculated the flows at just over 6,000 gallons per day and designed and built the system for $189,000. In 2006, the town of Teope, to address their straight pipe issues, contacted a local on-site design build firm to estimate for an estimate to build individual systems for each of their 22 homes. The original estimate was between $12,000 and $15,000 per home. When the project qualified for public funds, the MPCA determined that the funding source mandated a professional engineer to do the work or at least review the design. The final cost of just the construction was over $24,400 per home, which is more than the value of some of those homes. We don't know the final cost of the design work. If the on-site industry is to continue to provide an effective solution to rural wastewater issues and provide a cost-effective alternative to professionally engineered systems, we need to have statutory assurance that the agency honors this license and this statute to the historical ceiling of 10,000 gallons per day. The MS 326 licensing board needs to understand that the legislature exempts the activities of designing on-site systems under 10,000 gallons from enforcement for practicing engineering without a license and places it under this 115.56 license authority. If the training of the board licensed professional designers is superior, as they would like us to believe it is, they should be able to win all the work on an open field of competition based on the merits of their work and not force us to share it with them, as this report recommends. It does not matter how many or how few of these systems are designed each year. The historical effect of the 115.56 since 1996 is that many small construction or excavating firms, with full confidence that their license authorizes them to do the work, have made designing, building, and operating these systems part of their overall business plan. They have the right to continue offering this service to their communities without being forced to share the work with the engineering community. We need this legislation to protect a sufficient workforce to do the work of protecting the environment. Now, I was thinking about this on the way up here today. It's a nice long 2.5 hour drive, and I think I can boil it down to basically two issues or two statements. And the first one is stewardship, and the second one would be turf. When we accept our license under 115.56, we have a responsibility to produce designs that are good stewards of this environment, to protect the environment and protect human health. We also accept the responsibility to be good stewards of our customers' economic resources, whether they be private or whether they be small communities like Teope under public funds. There's limited resources out here to do these jobs. So stewardship is key. Mauer's mission statement is to protect the environment and protect public health through promoting professionalism within the on-site industry. So the stewardship of the land is key to the whole Mao organization and to this industry. But we also are very conscious of being a good steward of our customers' financial resources. The other element is turf. It's something that we don't want to put on this table. It's something we don't want to talk about. But the reality is we are protecting our turf. We need to. Been in this game for 35 years and up until 1996, anybody with a backhoe would put in a septic system. There was no licensing, there was no training. It was a problem. But after 1996, when the license and the training program and everything came around, we really did see a major increase in the quality of these systems. Now, these guys are not board licensed professional engineers or professional soil scientists or anybody else.
But they've learned their trade through the training that the university puts out. It's a very good program. Like Eric said, it's top-notch in the nation. Our trainers are recruited in every state. We just had our conference last week, and we had people from four or five different states just coming to listen to our programs. So I think that's the huge difference between comparing Minnesota with any other state. But the point is that these guys have built this industry and really have brought it a long way since 1996. We need to be able to compete on a level playing field. And going through the stakeholders' meetings, when the report came out, this agency report really does tilt that playing field into the board licensed professional arena. We have no desire to restrict the engineering community. They've always been able to compete one-on-one with us. But if this report or if the recommendations in the report were to take effect in any way, shape, or manner, then we would be at a huge disadvantage. And the report says that it'll have minimal business impact. But I think that they haven't thought that through in how the real world works. Thank you for your consideration on this.
Thank you, Mr. Jasperson. Any questions at all for Mr. Jasperson? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Jasperson. I don't know if this is a question to you or to the previous testifier, but I'm just wondering what has changed with regard to the design and installation in the past few years that would now require, the engineering degree. I believe, it's my understanding that you're still taking all the testing and going through everything that the university is putting out in those testing programs for the ISTS. I'm just wondering, has there been some data that shows significant failure of current licensed practitioners that have been working in this? Why? I'm just wondering what's motivating that.
Well, it's interesting. Thank you for the question. It's interesting that you ask for data, and we maintain that there really isn't any data that justifies, particularly the license change. What has changed is a redraft of the rule. The old rule 7080 has been broken into two rules, four rules, but primarily two that govern design, 7080 and 7081. 7081 covers from 5,000 gallons to 10,000 gallons. In the original concept of 7081, that was to be from 2,500 gallons to 10,000 gallons, which was interesting because that was in line with the exemption table of MS 326, and that's basically why we came last year, for protection from the MS 326 licensing board. But through the process of public hearings and et cetera, the rule changed to 5,000 gallons to 10,000, and it became apparent that the intent is basically the same, only just moved the ceiling. As far as evidence of failures, when we start talking about the mid-sized systems in particular, that's really what this is about. This isn't so much about the small on-site single-family dwelling system. This is about the mid-sized systems. I maintain that if the 115 on-site designers had the same ratio of failures that we see in the engineered design systems, we would have a serious problem and there would be an awful lot more discussion about what's going on. But we do not see that ratio of failures coming from the on-site designers that we see from the engineered community designers. And I think the reason for that is that, anyway, what I see as a supplier, and I review quite a few different plans from on-site and from engineers, is that engineers will tend to, in human nature, we tend to drift back to what we're trained the most in. They've attended the workshops, but they're trained in municipal wastewater. And when they try to apply municipal wastewater concepts to on-site concepts, it's a whole different world. All of their water has to go to the surface, to a ditch someplace. All of our water's got to go in the ground and stay there. And it's a whole different design concept. So I think that's, as far as what's changed, the rules are changing, and the rules are bringing in considerably more stringent requirements. But we are capable of meeting those requirements.
Mr. Jasperson, you're actually saying that the ones that the engineers have been constructing have actually experienced greater failure? Or is that?
I think the percentage or the ratio of failure would be higher. Now, to their defense, we don't see a lot of engineered systems in the under 10,000 gallon category. Where when we see an engineered system in the on-site world, we're talking in the $10,000 to $35,000 to $40,000 gallon category.
Representative Sale, I just wanted to follow up on that. Actually, this has been in existence for a number of years, that the subsurface sewage treatment system people are able to install and be able to do this work, and they've been successful at this work. There's a limited number, fewer than 35 professional engineers or soil scientists throughout the state of Minnesota that could actually perform this and have gone through the process to do this. So the people that are doing the work have received extensive education and background in order to be successful. One of the communities that Mr. Jasperson talked about is Teope. Teope is in my district. I have another small community that's not even technically a community, is Nickelville. I've talked about Nickelville for every year for the past 4 years, because I've carried a sewage treatment bill every year for the past 4 years. Nickelville has a straight pipe sewer system. Literally, the waste goes directly from a home into a creek, which is Dobbins Creek, which flows into the city of Austin eventually. Austin typically is a city that is fairly flat, and it floods not often, but frequently enough that it's a concern. And if you have sewage flowing through the creek, flowing into our city, that's a major concern. It's an environmental concern. It's a safety concern. It's something that the people of Nickelville, as the people of Teope, want to solve the problem. Fortunately, they have both been able to receive funds through the Public Facilities Authority, and this is just adding to that cost that we all pay in order to save. We need to be saving dollars, and we've been paying a higher price in order to have an engineer in those systems, when we can actually avoid that. We can still have the right people doing the job. It's going to save us money. It's going to be something that's going to be at high quality, and it's going to fix the problem, and it's something that we have to be concerned about. And so I would just appreciate your support on this legislation.
Senator Borghini is here.
We do have some letters of support that we wish to pass out as well.
Sure. Thank you. And Representative Wagenius.
I do have a question. We talk in this committee a lot about outcomes, and the outcome, for obviously, that you're talking about is protecting the groundwater. We are likely to find more and more need to increase standards. What I hear from you is you don't resist the increase of standards. Is that true? Standards?
Absolutely. Our association does not resist the increase in standards. 4 or 5 years ago, our organization was very involved in working with the agency and developing these new licenses. The reason that we asked for new licenses is that we did realize that there's small contractors out there that are installing pre-treatment systems that they don't know about. The training prior to now was voluntary. The training exists out there. The university gives us that training, or we buy it from them. But the training is out there, and they get it. Now, we do like to see the standards to raise the bar in the industry.
Actually, I think I understood that part. I'm talking about increasing standards, in other words, making your systems more protective of the groundwater, making your systems perhaps of higher quality, because we're seeing problems with our groundwater, and we see problems all over the state. Do you resist raising those standards?
Not at all.
Can you be helpful in increasing those standards?
Mr. Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes, as a matter of fact, our organization has been very actively engaged, both at the agency level, at the university level, in developing procedures and methods in the industry for doing exactly that. And one of the things that really has brought that to a head is situations with restricted space. You know, a septic system drain field typically takes a lot of area. And so the history has been that you always just build another one. And it doesn't take a whole lot of excessive loading, and they've lost their effective use. And the way to eliminate that or to reduce that is to treat the waste before it gets to the drain field. So it's a pre-treatment type technology. Our firm uses 10 different technologies right now today for doing exactly that. So they're very commonplace, and we're leading the charge. And in fact, you know, we've got the ability now to design and build systems that are theoretically lifetime systems with replaceable renewable parts and protecting the soil treatment system. And through that, the reason that works is because the pollutants are held back or eliminated organically either by screens or some other method in the tanks where we can take them out mechanically and put them back on the soil where they belong and preserving the groundwater. People start getting there. Is that clear?
That's clear, and that's helpful. I think something we're going to have to do more and more of in the future. And some folks come around here and lobby against increasing standards, and I just wanted to hear your position on that.
And in fact, the new 7080, 7081, 2 and 3, we supported, and our organization asked for a model standard, model code, quite some years ago, 7 or so years ago, we were advocating for just this thing. And the reason being that we see the need out there. And the beauty of it is that there's a tremendous number of technologies that can be brought in. And many of them are not new at all. We use some that are 30-some years old and treat to extremely high standards. You know, you have water coming out of tanks that you don't know is not drinking water. It's coming out of what would have been a septic tank before, very commonly.
Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, we do have one person who wants to testify in opposition, I believe, Mr. Mom.
Mr. Chair, may I say one thing here?
Sure.
The three letters that Ron mentioned to hand out, we've got letters of support from Minnesota, the Congress of Minnesota Resorts. They deal with this issue on a regular basis, and there's enough for all the committee members. We have a letter from a county regulator who can describe the impacts on counties if this were to become the rule. And we also have a letter of support from Camp Onomia, which is one that Ron Jasperson talked about earlier, that was able to stay in business because of an on-site system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. And Mr. Malm? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Brian Malm. I'm a licensed professional engineer, and I'm here to testify on behalf of both the Minnesota Society of Professional Engineers as well as the American Council of Engineering Companies. MSPE and ACEC are opposed to the language that's included in this House File 3643. I was also a member of the stakeholders group that was met last year between August and December, as requested by the legislature as a part of last year's bill. Stakeholders group was comprised of septic system contractors, engineers, soil scientists, geologists, state board of licensure representatives, county representatives, MPCA staff, as well as U of M representatives. MPCA staff listened to input from all of the stakeholders, and the report that you have in front of you today, which I realize all of you have probably not had a chance to read, but this is the summary and the recommendation that the MPCA put together after listening to input from all of the stakeholders that are involved in this issue. You heard testimony just a minute ago from representatives from MAWA. They are only one of the stakeholders that are involved in this issue. There are several other stakeholders who work in this industry, who are knowledgeable in this industry, and were involved in the stakeholders group. MPCA did listen to input from all of those groups. The report that was delivered to you represents what most of the stakeholders felt was in the best interest in protecting the environment. Unfortunately, the bill that you're considering today is a result of one of the stakeholders' dissatisfaction with the consensus of the rest of the group. The MPCA report recommends that board licensed professionals, that being professional engineers, soil scientists or geologists, and MPCA-licensed advanced designers, and that would be septic system contractors who have gone through the MPCA licensing program. It would require that all of those people be involved in a team approach in systems with flows larger than 5,000 gallons per day, and that would be a system that would serve about 15 homes or more. And it would also require it for some systems between 2,500 and 5,000 gallons per day, which would be somewhere between 8 and 15 homes. MSP and ACEC both agree with this recommendation for several reasons, including systems with a flow greater than 5,000 gallons per day or greater than 15 homes, they do pose a greater risk to the environment, and therefore a higher standard should be used and required in the design of those systems. Requiring that both board licensed professionals and advanced designers licensed through the MPCA be required to be involved in the design of these systems is that higher standard. Systems with a flow of greater than 5,000 gallons per day, they do involve more complicated and advanced design tasks, such as hydrogeologic studies. That's studying the geology of the ground beneath the system, the soils in the system, and determining how that wastewater entering the soil will impact the groundwater. And that's important because nitrogen going into the groundwater is a problem with drinking water wells, and we want to protect that groundwater. If the hydrogeologic study shows that nitrogen is an impact to the groundwater or phosphorus is an impact to the surface water, you may have to design a nitrogen or phosphorus treatment system. The new MPCA rule does require that. These designs require the expertise that engineers, soil scientists, and geologists bring to the table. If you don't require engineers, soil scientists, or geologists to be involved in the design of these systems, the MPCA will be required to develop a training program to teach the septic system contractors how to do these things. Design nitrogen and phosphorus treatment systems, to do hydrogeologic studies. This is not a small undertaking. Mala has mentioned several times that, well, we know what we need to know. We've developed the need to know. We know we need to learn how to protect the groundwater with respect to looking at groundwater modeling and hydrogeologic studies and nitrogen treatment. We know what we need to know, but there has been no training program developed for that yet. The PCA, if you ask PCA staff, they have not developed design tools for those things yet. So it's easy to say that the knowledge will be there and the education and training will be there, but it doesn't exist yet. The only place that exists, that knowledge and experience exists right now, is in the engineering, soil science, and geology community. We do not feel it is reasonable or necessary for MPCA to develop a training and testing curriculum that will be adequate to provide the necessary knowledge for the septic system professionals to perform this work. This is especially true when it's recognized that the systems being discussed here represent less than 1% of all of the septic systems that are being installed in the state of Minnesota. So you're asking the PCA to develop a very extensive training program to address just a few systems. It's not necessary. There are already professionals out there who can work with advanced designers that will be trained by the MPCA to design these systems and bring the expertise that's necessary to the table. In conclusion, the report submitted by the MPCA was specifically requested by the legislature after much deliberation on this issue last year. The report includes the input of all stakeholders involved in this issue, as well as the recommendation of the state regulatory agency that's charged with protecting the environment, the PCA. The bill you're considering represents the input of only one group who is not happy with this report. And they've mentioned that they're concerned about market share. This requirement in this report recommendation by the MPCA does not remove them from the market and does not limit their market share. They would have the opportunity to work in the market as an advanced designer on these systems. In fact, it's actually required that they be involved in the system. So it does not remove them from the market and does not limit the market to them. But this should not be about market share. This should be about what's the best thing to do is for the environment. Who should be designing these systems to make sure that we've got systems that are protecting the environment? I did want to refute a couple of things that they mentioned in their testimony specifically. One, and this has been floating around for a long time, they've mentioned this last year and they mentioned it today, but this high rate of failure with engineered systems. And quite frankly, I wasn't very educated on that until just a few weeks ago, but there were seven systems that received USDA funding that were analyzed with respect to whether they had actually failed or not. And I got a copy of the reports that looked at those systems to find out really what happened to these systems. Not seven of these systems can be considered to be failing. Only about two of the systems could actually be considered to be failing at this point. None of them are operating the way they were expected to operate. But because they were engineered systems doesn't mean that the engineering was bad. When I look at the reports that were developed on these systems, two of the systems had design that was not proper. It was designed actually by the same engineer. The rest of the systems, the reason they're not operating the way they were expected is because they weren't operated and maintained the way they were supposed to be. The operator did not follow the operation and maintenance instructions that were developed for the project. If you don't operate and maintain a system the way it's designed and the way it's intended to, it's not going to work right. That's not a design failure, that's an operation failure. The reports also indicate that there was improper construction techniques that were used on these systems, improper materials. And that has nothing to do with design, that has to do with how the system is constructed. So I would refute the claim that there's this high rate of failure with engineered systems. There were some problems, but those seven systems weren't the only systems that were designed by engineers. So I think it's improper to say and qualify that as a high rate of failure. The other thing I want to refute is, talk about this higher cost. Yes, it is more expensive to hire an engineer to design your system than it is to hire a contractor to design your system. But there's a reason for that. When engineers design systems, we're looking at long-term solutions, not quick and cheap solutions. We're looking at the owner's interest with respect to quality and longevity. And these examples that they can use as comparisons from when the septic system contractor put together a cost estimate and the cost was $10,000 or $12,000 per household, the engineer came in and all of a sudden it's $25,000. It's not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison. I don't know the specifics of those situations, but I've been involved in enough projects to know that the scope changes in a project from the beginning to the end. We don't know, I don't know what the specifics were with respect to what kind of system was being proposed by the septic system contractor and what kind of system did the community ultimately choose. One of the mistakes that can be made when you're looking at this is minimalizing the community's choice when they're looking at what they want their wastewater solution to be. Could very well, engineers don't force solutions on communities. Communities choose solutions from options. If there was an option for a system that was $12,000 per hookup versus an option for a system that was $25,000 per hookup, I highly doubt that they made that choice for the $25,000 per hookup system based on the fact that they wanted to pay more money. There were likely other reasons that they chose the more expensive system. And so I would caution you against listening to those things and generalizing the fact that engineered systems are more costly. The third thing I wanted to refute is the comment about there being a lack of engineers to do this work. I don't doubt that there are less than 35 engineers who are trained as professional engineers, as well as engineers who have gone through the MPCA training specific to soil-based treatment systems. But again, there is no program currently and no training and testing curriculum currently to train septic system contractors in these advanced designs. So if we're talking about people available today who are qualified to design these systems, there may be less than 35 engineers available, but currently there are no septic system contractors who have gone through this training because there is no training yet. And I guess I would follow that up with the comment that training hasn't been developed. And that's all I had to say.
Okay. Thank you. And as far as the issue of the expenses, and I know you're saying that they're comparing apples to oranges here because you talk about different septic systems. Is there a comparison that can be made as far as the same kind of systems, as far as what the cost difference would be between an engineered system and
I don't know of any specific examples, but I couldn't sit here and tell you that that an engineered design system would be cheaper than a contractor design system. I know the level of quality that we go through and the level of effort that we go through in developing a set of plans. And it can be as simple as when I develop a set of plans for a project, we're going out and we're doing a topographic survey. We're putting together a set of detailed plans designed on CAD.
just all of the details of the system laid out in a set of plans and specifications that the owner can review and understand exactly what they're getting, and then they're given to a contractor to bid. The contractor knows exactly what he's bidding on, and there's a measure of performance with respect to what was on the plans and what's being built. I know that on contractor design systems, on smaller systems, that set of detailed plans and specifications doesn't exist. Maybe a plan view of a system as far as how it's going to be laid out, where the septic tank is going to be. But there are no detailed specifications and plans on most of the designs that I've seen. So that's one area where there's a cost, but there's a value in the cost. If the system isn't built according to the plans and specifications, there's a recourse for the owner. You go back and look at the plans, and you point out this is how it's supposed to be, and this is not what it looks like in the field. If you do not have that set of plans, and you had not put that level of effort and quality into the development of those plans, you would have nothing to fall back on. It's more of a handshake agreement.
Ms. Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one question. I noticed that in some of the information here, the Minnesota Association of County Planning and Zoning Administrators had a survey, and when I just look at some of these numbers, the results would seem to support the language in this bill. And earlier you remarked something about concern for market share. I was just wondering where the counties would be, if the counties are lining up with this bill, how would counties see market share as a problem?
I couldn't comment on counties' opinions on this. I guess I'm not a county representative. I apologize.
Okay. I don't know if there's anyone here. Counties who would want to testify? Welcome. State your name for the record.
My name is Annalie Garlitz. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties. As to the question about the market share, I'm not certain about the answer. To that, I know when talking with different counties about this bill, I heard all kinds of responses and about the study that was done, and I know that we had a representative that was on that committee talking about all of these different things, and it was Terry Neff from Aitken County. And he was on the committee. He's a member of the Planning and Zoning Administrators Association. The largest concern that I've heard statewide was that they still want to see, I know that Olmsted County, for instance, they still want to be able to require more stringent guidelines for the county if that's what they see is necessary. I know Olmsted County requires to have an soil planning and an engineer to do septic systems in that county. And as long as, because of their geologic conditions in that county and their soil conditions. So as long as it's something that a local unit of government can still indicate they need to be more strict, I think that's the main concern that I have with the language, if that's something that's identified in that certain geographic region, that they need to be comfortable with the permitted system. But going back to the question about market share, I'm sorry, I'm able to answer that.
A follow-up on that. I was just, when I was listening to the testimony of the gentleman, I'm sorry, I don't call your name. I'm sorry. But market share seemed to be a concern. You know, he thought that was one of the motivating factors for wanting to change the standard, and I just wondered if the counties seem to have a lot of support for this. They don't obviously, most likely, have too much concern about market share, so I wondered how that fit into that.
Representative Bobby, did you have a response to or question?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Taylor. I just wanted to respond about the Olmsted County issue. This bill does not preclude the counties from having more strict regulations. So, and Olmsted County has contacted me, and they were fine with this. They just didn't want to be, this is a minimum standard. They can have more strict regulations.
Representative Olin. Representative
Wagenius.
I think probably my question is for PCA, but who knows. I'm interested in knowing what the design life standard is for no matter who is installing it. Is there a minimum standard of how long the system is going to last? Whether it's for an individual, whether it's for a mid-size, whether it's for a large.
Mr. Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Genius. Yes, in fact, the standard for a residential system, the standard assumption is that if we follow the design guidelines for our current training program, we can represent that as a 20 to 25 year life system. And in fact, that's really because of some loading rates. In fact, most people use about one third of the water that we design these for. Commercial systems, when we do our resort systems instead, we generally design for a 40 year lifespan.
Oh, right.
40 year lifespan. And also be the same as an engineered lifespan in that 25 to 40 range. And to do that, we have to control the soil loading very strictly.
Okay.
Yes. When I hear what you are doing, I think my more basic question, are there minimum legal standards? And perhaps that's a question when PCA comes up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
First, I guess we have Representative Breinhardt has a question.
No, actually, Mr. Chair, I wanted to hear from the MPCA on the whole issue, so I want to get your perspective on the strengths and weaknesses of the legislation.
Mr.
Chair and Representative Reiner, thank you for the segue. I'm Gretchen Sable with the Pollution Control Agency. I work in the Subsurface Sewage Treatment Systems Program, which we fondly call SSTS. Easier to say. A lot has been said here about our rule and the report, and so I kind of thought we'd start with Representative Saylor's question about what changed, and then move into the report and how the report grew. Our rule was first became mandatory statewide in 1996, and that was when the licensing program started. At that point, most of the business was in the small end systems. We'd had voluntary standards for 20 years before that, and we kind of morphed those into a minimum state code and built from there. But things changed. There have been more and more large systems built now. AOP is an example of a community that's looking to on-site solutions for, because of the cost and because of the convenience and a number of other factors. And so as we've moved into this field, what started as prescriptive standards, like the plumbing code, this big, this deep, this wide, build it like this, morphed into things where we were concerned about performance outcomes, groundwater loading, groundwater mounding, and some of those things that you can't necessarily prescriptively design for. And so a year ago, we went into the rule process with a proposed rule with, like Mr. Jesperson said, a split at 2,500 gallons. And so everything below 2,500 gallons would be this big, this deep, this high, the prescriptive standards. And above that, we were basically outcome-based. It said you need to meet drinking water standards for groundwater. You need to protect surface water from phosphorus. And it didn't tell you how. And we were, so that kind of led to some concerns about, well, how do we train these people? And so we went into the rule process with unanswered questions. When we went through hearings, we had a lot of 1,300 comments on our rule. And we made some changes, and one of the big changes was to move the line from 2,500 to 5,000 gallons. And we did that so that we kind of had fewer systems that had to meet this. It was a compromise where the outcome standards are still met by these largest systems. We have a little bit of increased requirements for 2,500 to 5,000 gallons per day, and that's basically like 8 homes to 15 homes, and then 15 to 30 would be the 5 to 10,000 gallons. So we're not talking a lot, but there's also resorts and other kinds of entities there. So anyhow, we have a little bit more required, some performance-based outcomes for the 2,500 to 5,000, and largely performance-based for the big ones. Okay, so that was how the rule ended up being structured when we went into the stakeholder meetings in August. The rule became final in, January. It's actually final now. February 4th was our effective date. But our board approved it in October, so we've known for some time how the rule was going to look. So we started the stakeholder work then with the knowledge that we'd be at 5,000 gallons for the limit. and we started looking at what kind of information do you need to have to be able to correctly design a septic system. And I apologize, the report's jargony, you know, we talk among ourselves a lot and it's hard to understand. If you look in the back of the report, my copy's in color, I don't know if yours is, there's a table here. We had worked through this table as kind of a tool that we were using as we went through the things. And you'll see some of the kind of work that needs to be done. So if you read this, on the left-hand column, it shows the size. We call an ISTS small type 1 to 3. So what that means, it's a trench system, a mound system, your basic kind of prescriptive standards. The next one there, next row, is type 4 and 5. These are the ones that use pretreatment. A type 4 will use something called a registered product. So it'll be a pretreatment product that's been registered with the state of Minnesota, where it's kind of a plug-and-play kind of system. You'll know how to use it in our systems, and it's simple and prescriptive in nature. A type 5 is more outcome-based, and so there's different requirements there. So anyhow, so that's what that is. ISTS large, then, is that 2,500 to 5,000. And MSTS, or mid-size, is 5 to 10. And you can see that the rule type shifts from performance to prescriptive as you go down the list. And then we look at some of the tasks that need to be done. You have to determine if you're going to impact an aquifer. How do you do that? You have to determine if you're going to impact, surface water for phosphorus, impact shallow groundwater. So you go on. You can see the different kinds of skills that are needed. And basically, when we did this, a D is a current designer. People that are today registered with us as septic system designers are basic designers. The AD is a new classification. Mr. Malm said that this doesn't exist yet. The training hasn't been developed. There are today no advanced designers. There will be in 3 years. So this is where the advanced designers, once this is operational, will be required. Anyhow, so yellow boxes are the areas where we couldn't agree. As we worked through this, we said that a fairly simple system, a type 1 through 4 system that's prescriptive in nature, 25 to 5,000 gallons, is basically the work of an advanced designer because they're going to be trained in that. But if you're getting into a type 5, the outcome-based system, then you need to involve somebody that has deeper knowledge, more training. The people that are trained in septic work attend classes with the university for 3 days, 5 days, 2 weeks. And it is not similar in curriculum to the knowledge that you get in a engineering curriculum in a 4-year degree. The people that come in from engineering have much broader knowledge of different things. They're trained in a number of areas, collection systems and things like that you just can't do in these shorter classes with the university. And so when things become more outcome-based and you have to have this broader knowledge behind you, that was where the agency thought that for now, involving these people in these systems, at least until we're able to develop prescriptive guidance, and that's what is in your bill, the design guidance. So we're working to develop the registered products. We're working to say, and this is how you do this kind of a thing, but we don't know the answers on that yet. And so until that time, that's why we have the two-phase thing here. We'll have a team approach for a number of years, and then we would reevaluate. And so, to make a long story longer, we had not given a legislative recommendation in this report because people didn't agree, and because the sunset date was in the law already, they gave us time to develop these tools, and then we knew we could come back and say, this is what we'd like to do. We have a commitment to continue to work on the design guidance. We have a commitment to continuing to work with the university to develop the training that needs to happen. We're changing our exams. We have to answer all these questions. Anyhow, we liked having the extra time, so that was why we didn't come to you with a recommendation.
Thank you.
Well, my team and I just go.
Any questions at all for Mr. Pioneer?
Actually,
yeah, we do have, yes.
I did ask a question about, do we have minimum standards for how long systems, no matter what the size, should last?
Mr. Chairman, we had a number of the components in the rule require a 25-year life on piping and tanks and things like that. So I think that 25 was kind of the target we were using. we don't say the system must last that long because it's hard to say what kind of care it's going to get and what kind of disease it might get. So we step back from legislating in our rule.
Representative Virginia?
That's very frustrating because, of course, you're asking for bonding dollars for these things and you bond for something and it lasts 20 years and you have to rebuild it.
Mm-hmm.
So I come back with the question of, say it was maintained. Do we have a minimum standard, whether it's a household or a medium-sized or a large one, do we have a minimum design life standard?
Representative Virginia's answer, the short answer is no. The long answer is that we don't know that there would be anything that would make it die. The system I have at my house was first designed, undersized, in the wrong place, didn't look at soils, and when it failed after 8 years, we replaced it with a system that's big, high, and dry, like we like them. Our family's actually using half the system and we rotate back and forth. And I don't have any reason to think that my system won't still be working at my house when we're dead and gone. So, you know, I think that by building them carefully with more safety factors built in, that you get greater longevity. I'm sorry.
But the frustration is you're telling me about your system, and what I want to know is if can a citizen expect that when a system is designed by, you know, for a small one or a medium and a large one, it will last a certain number of years. And I do think we need, I mean, that's part of outcomes, that it's designed to last a certain number of years, because you can't tell what you're buying if you can't compare two things unless there is a final outcome. And one of the final outcomes is how long does this last? It's not just how much flow goes through, but how long does this thing last? And I find it very frustrating not to have some measure of how long something is going to last that will keep sinking so much money into this.
Mr. Chairman, from the beginning, some of the things that we've done are to require systems to be larger. So especially for these... the MSTS over 5,000 gallons, we're requiring that they have two sites for drain fields, that they actually build extra capacity and rotate the drain fields, that they're going to probably have pre-treatment, which, like Mr. Larson said, you replace components of them and you get greater longevity. And so those are the things that we're doing to make them more versatile and more appropriate for the permanent part of our infrastructure.
Design a bridge that way.
Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Poppy, I read through the report while we were going through everything here. It appears to me that the issue boils down to who does the work between 5,000 and 10,000 gallons, and does the work that they do, or will the work that they do, impact water quality? I mean, to bring it to the jurisdiction we have here for the environment, I mean, is the choice we have to make is, does that fence, is it going to, we're hearing differences of opinion from the agency and from interested parties on whether or not that question of between 5,000 and 10,000 gallons of who designs that will impact the environment. And so we're left with a variety, but I'm sitting here thinking that we're going to have that disagreement. We can do another study. We can make another recommendation. But ultimately, I keep thinking about this is why the cost of these things keeps going up, is we keep making these things maybe more complicated than they need to be. And so the responsibility of whoever signs off on that, whether they're a licensed geoscientist or engineer or somebody who's been through the training, there's still going to be liability there. But we want to make sure that the system works and that protects the environment. But we also want to make sure people can afford them and make them, get them in the ground, so they're not trying to avoid this ever spiraling increase in cost for individual system. So I'm going to vote with you on this. It's a difficult choice, but at some point we have to make a decision.
Thank you.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen. I will say this in response. Since 1996, the SSTS designers have been doing design and installation of up to 10,000 gallons. So it's been happening for a decade or longer. So it has been successful. They have received the kind of training that allows them to provide the high quality. It's been something that's happened for a number of years. We're just asking for it to go into the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one quick comment. Some of us up in more remote areas that haven't got engineers wandering all over our yards, I have no choice but to rely on people that are willing to do this work, and we do need this type of bill to pass, because quite frankly, if we got to do engineers, we're going to come to a screeching halt and be done with the world.
And Ms. Abel.
Mr. Chair, I've been trained not to argue on the stand. This is not to say that engineers are needed on all systems. This is only to say that engineers are needed in situations where it's outcome-based and we don't have prescriptive standards. And it's also to say that engineers would be required, you know, in the, that there would be a change in the future, a reevaluation and a change. I think that what I'm arguing for, not to be disrespectful, is to maintain the sunset date and kind of keep things at the status quo until we're able to work more out. And I'm afraid that if we preclude certain solutions now, that we won't end up at the right place environmentally where we need to be.
Representative Olin.
And I think what my comment addresses is the fact some of our counties are not happy with the fact they ever changed the rules in the first place. And mine happens to be one of them, so you know how I'm voting.
Well, and as has been stated, I mean, we have had contractors that have been constructing these systems, and we have not seen, I have not heard of any major problems or failures. I mean, there's failures, but as far as the percentage of failures, it's not exceedingly high compared to failures that to see among engineered systems. Would that be correct? I know that that was one of the things that Mr. Mulma addressed, and but if you could address that as well, Ms. Abel.
Mr. Chair, the definition of failure for a septic system is, does the water come to the surface? And if the water's coming to the surface, it's not contaminating groundwater. What we've tried to do with our rules is to look at a groundwater emphasis as well. And that really changes the design of the system and the types of skills that are needed to do it. We have a commitment to expanding the prescriptive knowledge in the future, but it's not there yet. And we've kind of taken a step with the rule. There's a number of implementations, you know, a couple of year, 3 year period where we're going to be doing all this work to make those changes. But our goal was to improve groundwater protection. And we don't have a criteria in our rule for testing groundwater to determine if it fails.
See, so you're saying that we don't have a handle on whether what the number of failures are.
Right. So we believe that the old design standard, when a septic system works, it takes the organic nitrogen that goes into the system, converts it to nitrate. The nitrate goes down into the groundwater. The nitrate is a concern in groundwater. And when so a working system is designed to do that. And so you need to do different things to make it not do that. And that's where we're kind of feeling our way into that level of groundwater protection. And that's what changed. Because our rule changed, some of these new categories are added.
I don't know if you could address, too, the issue of a lack of engineers or a shortage of engineers to address the growing needs. And it sounds like we're moving more and more to these larger systems. So there's more of them, and there's, I don't see a greater number of engineers being
Mr. Chair, I don't, right now there's, I think 30 was the number that was used, engineers and soil scientists that are cross-licensed as septic people. And so there's a couple of factors at hand. One is that if they weren't required to do that, there wasn't really a market for it, and so that market, if it changed, would develop more people to do the work. The other thing is that we're not saying that the designers wouldn't be involved, and so they'd just be working in a team with the engineers, and so
some of the things we have to work out yet is, do the engineers also have to be licensed as septic people or not? So it could be that they would just hire a off-the-shelf engineer. I don't want to... who knows how to do collection systems doesn't necessarily understand septic systems, but they would do the collection system portion of it. They'd bring in a geoscientist that can look at the mounding and then leave the design to the septic person once they understand the separation that has to be achieved. So I think that we have a lot of things that we're working on yet and we don't have good answers for. So a lot of those will affect it. There's an issue, too, about training. I think that was maybe what you were getting at, Mr. Taylor, when you were asking about county concerns. If you look in the back of our report, you know, there was certainly not, I can't say that word, everybody didn't agree. And so we actually included statements from the different groups here, so you can see it in their words. And when you see Terry Neff's statement in the back there on the AMC letterhead, he raises the issue that he's concerned that the advanced designer, our new category, is going to get too hard. And he wants us to change our rule. The other way to handle that would be to change how hard that has to be by limiting the work they have to do by saying certain other elements this would be done by registered professionals. So, different ways to skin the cat, and we have to work on them.
As far as given the limited number of engineers, you're saying 30, I think I heard 30 to 35
engineers. I don't know.
Just wondering if there's any information as far as the distribution of these engineers in the state. They're concentrated in the metropolitan area?
Mr. Chair, septic systems themselves are kind of concentrated from the north of Brainerd area down through the Twin Cities. That's our biggest concentration of septic, and that population gets more sparse as well. So we see that the bulk of the septic contractors are there. When you get up into the Red River Valley, there's hardly anybody working up there. When we're out in Redwood County, their phone book covers everything from Redwood to the corner, and there's 8 people listed for septic. So, there's not a lot of people on either side of the fence, and people travel distances to do the work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to take a little bit different take than Representative Hansen on the report. I find it a little problematic that we asked for this work to get done and that it's barely been issued and we're thinking about bypassing it. My perspective is we need to give it at least some time. So whether it's to the sunset, give it at least some time. So whether it's to the sunset date or, we report back after a year or how it would work, but I find it problematic to ignore the findings of this report. So I'm going to vote against it.
Vote.
Any other... Any other questions? We do have a few other testifiers. Mr. David Oxley. Thank you, Ms. Davis. Representative Scalzi.
I'm just concerned it's 7:45. We've heard 4 bills, and I think we have 6 left, and I'm just kind of wondering, is there going to be an adjournment time at midnight, or are we going to try a different day, or are we going to wade through these, or are we going to have a time limit?
Well, I'm not planning to be here until midnight. I think that we'll be finishing up before midnight. Some of these bills will not take nearly as long. We won't be going beyond midnight, I can guarantee you that.
Do you have an estimated time of adjournment that we could maybe...
Well, I don't.
Okay.
Because we'd go as long as it takes to get through the bills. Mr. Oxley is not here, so... Okay. I can already talk, so that's the only testifiers we have. So, any final comments?
Thank you for your consideration, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Great. Okay. Seeing no other discussion, we will bring it to a vote. So I will renew the motion that House File 3643. You recommended the pass and referred to the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevailed. It was passed. And there's been a couple of bills that have also been pulled off the agenda, Representative Scalzi, including the second one. No problem. I understand. The next bill has been pulled off the agenda.
Thank you.
Also, for your information, Representative Burns' bill has been off the agenda. Representative Marquardt, would like to step forward?
Hurry it up.
And Representative Marquardt, welcome. I'll move House File 3541. We recommend it to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Local Government.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. The House File 3541, those of us who have townships, which I know you do, Mr. Chair, that today is Township Day.
Yes.
Where they vote and set their budget for actually the next year, 09. And this bill addresses the budget. And we need clarification here, but basically what happens here is that a ditch authority like a watershed district could build a culvert for a ditch project that they have, and the road authority, who would be the township, would be responsible for all of those expenses, the roadway and the culvert and so forth, and ultimately could get a bill after they set their budget, and it's pretty restrictive budget. They could get a bill from the watershed district saying, now you owe this because this was part of our project. So what this would say is that watershed districts and drainage authorities and that would have to pay up. It's their project, and they've got to put the culvert in. They got to use part of the road and repair. That would go to the drainage authority rather than to the township. Now, what I've heard is they tend to, in reality, negotiate on this type of thing, the drainage authority and the township. But what we're looking in state law, and this is brought to me by the Minnesota Township Association, it doesn't say that in law, and so somehow we need to clarify that. So I've got Mr. Kent Sulem from the Minnesota Township Association. He's going to quickly talk about that.
Mr. Sulem, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kent Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. And this issue was brought to us by one of our township members for a situation that had arisen or was believed to have arisen in his township shortly before the original committee time recess. We received a phone call. There may have been some differing facts than what we had originally been made aware of. But as Representative Marquardt indicated, there seems to be some areas where there's a breakdown in communication or some misunderstandings occurring. And with the way the current law is drafted, it appears to allow that even if the township doesn't have an input or doesn't request the change for the culvert or the road, they could get stuck with the bill. I've been made aware that there is a group that's planning to meet this summer to address a number of drainage issues, and they have requested that we work with them on this matter. And so if it is this committee's desire, I am more than happy to try to do that. But it is an issue we felt important to bring forward in terms of the concept of what we're trying to achieve, because I think a lot of people misunderstood the bill. And all I was intending to say is, if the road authority needs the improvement of the new culvert or bridge, we pay for it. But if it's being done strictly for drainage purposes by the ditch authority, which can be the watershed district or the county in most situations, then their taxing authority should pick up the cost, and not the road authority get sprung by surprise. So that's our goal. That's what we're trying to achieve, is clarification on that point. And so with that, like I said, you know, I know that several of you have been contacted by other people with concerns about unintended consequences of it. My commitment is to work with those who want to do it, but we want to get on the record what we need to achieve and welcome any input from committee members.
Okay, Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, I know we have Ron here and Ron Harnack who have concerns, and I guess I'm just going to say I probably would like to see this bill tabled so we could all work together, and I don't know if they still need to testify, but they had certainly concerns about this, but they're also willing to have a group here in sake of time unless they want to still testify. I would ask that you table the bill and that they work in the interim on this issue, and they've been very agreeable to that, and I appreciate them bringing the concerns forward today.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt and Mr. Sulem, and yes, we will lay the bill on the table and give you time to work on differences and come up with a consensus. So, thank you.
Thank you.
How are we doing, Representative Kelsey?
I am.
Oh, no, I understand.
It's cold.
And we now have Representative Gunther. Would you like to... Welcome to the committee, Representative Gunther. And I will move the move House File 3890, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Local Government. And I understand that you're presenting for Representative Finstead tonight.
That's correct. He had to go to his district for a meeting, and we share the same county, one county. So
okay.
I'm glad to do this. We have amendment, the H3890A1 amendment, that would make put the bill in the shape that Representative Finstead would like to have it.
I will move the H3890A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this bill is here because a group of soil and water conservation supervisors didn't like the idea of having to report, like you and I have to the ethics board, what they own and so forth. I think one person said, I'm not going to do this, and the rest of them followed him. I'm not sure. I think I knew it was. But anyway, because of that, we were in a dilemma that we've never been in before, and that we've never had every member of a Soil and Water Conservation District resign right before the deal. So Mr. Jasky here worked hard and came up with a temporary solution, and we're trying to take that temporary solution and make it permanent. And he's certainly here to answer any questions you have. I think that pretty much covers the dilemma we were put in. This bill, with the amendment, does exactly what it's supposed to do. We will replace those people without having a judge somewhere do it for us.
Okay.
People will have their voice heard.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gunther. And Mr. Jasky.
Mr. Chairman, members, John Jasky, Executive Director, Board of Water and Soil Resources, and just a couple more pieces of background. I don't know who it was, but the county, Mr. Coleman is not here today. He's the county auditor from Watonwan County, and he and the county board, actually, they sought a solution to this in district court, and they asked the court to appoint soil and water board members until the general election, which is occurring this fall, and the court thought about it, and several months later they said, well, no, we don't want to do that. We want you to hold a special election, which they certainly can do, and the special election would be held in Watonwan County. It would cost between $15,000 and $20,000, which is, you know, quite a bit of money in their county, and basically would come out of the coffers that would have been otherwise used for conservation purposes. So this legislation would simply allow the county board to appoint soil and water district supervisors to serve out the term until the general election is held, and then they're seated in January, and they have more than enough folks who are interested and capable and ready to go. So this would be a very short-term, one-time solution. And it would save the county $20,000 to have a special election otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Jasky, and I know how dear those funds are right now, so... any questions at all for Representative Hansen?
Good bill.
There you have it. So, any other comments? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 3890 be recommended as amended, be recommended to pass, and we refer it to the Committee on Local Government. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Thank you. I think Representative Scalzi helped speed things along here.
They're neither going to be heard.
I
will
more passes. We have next House File 3432 is Representative Bill here. Representative Bill.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to bring House File 3433 before it's recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee.
Okay. Representative Bill moves that House File 3433 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee Which committee? The Committee on Finance.
On Committee on Finance. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Representative Virginia.
Environment Finance?
No, the Committee on Finance.
This actually needs to go to the Committee on Environment Finance. That's,
but we have to go to Finance
first.
Sure.
Okay. With the recommendation they come back to.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with that motion, but we'll discuss it, and then maybe I will agree with to it at that time. Thank you. Matt, members, I have the 33A1 amendment. I'd like to get the bill in the shape that I would like it to be, and the author would like it, so I'd like to move the 33A1 amendment.
Okay, Representative. Okay, the amendment is coming around, so we'll. And Representative Dill, maybe you can go ahead and speaking to it until the amendment
is handled. Thank you very much, members. The bill is about the establishment of the Lake Vermilion State Park in St. Louis County. And as you know, members, you may know that we have in St. Louis County, in my legislative district, we have 10 state parks already. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to wait till the amendment's out.
The amendment is, yeah.
No, it's the 33A1 amendment.
I got two.
Okay, so it's a different amendment that's coming around. We disregard then the amendment that's in the packet.
Yeah, that's correct.
The amendment that's in the packet is disregarded.
Okay.
We are going to be moving the one hand being handed out.
Same thing.
Different.
Oh,
okay. 33 instead of
43. They are
the same. They're different amendments, different numbers on them.
It's
the 33A1, not the 43A1.
All right.
Hey, everybody have a copy of the amendment?
Mm-hmm.
And we will move the amendment to get it in the shape and form that the author would like.
Correct.
So I will, Representative Dill, renews his motion to adopt the 33A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is about the establishment of the Vermilion State Park. As you know, the governor has come out some months ago and the Department of Natural Resources indicating that they wanted to establish a new state park in my legislative district up on Lake Vermilion. It consists of about 3,000 acres of land that U.S. Steel purchased in about 1882 or so. So it's a long been owned by the U.S. Steel Corporation, which operates a taconite mine and processing facility on the Iron Range. Members, I want to tell you that we really support the park. We think it's a fine idea. It's an exceptional piece of land that is will not be replicated again in this state. It is exceptional. And its beauty is beyond that of any type lands like this in the state. And we should move forward and make this a park. But along that journey are some very trepid waters, as a matter of speech. In my legislative district, there is 1.2 million acres of wilderness in the boundary waters. There's about 2.2 million acres of Superior National Forest that is beyond what is in the boundary waters. There's 237,000 acres of Voyageurs National Park, which is primarily located in northern St. Louis County, probably over 200,000 acres of the total park of Voyageurs National Park. Minnesota's only state park, or national park, is located in northern St. Louis County. In St. Louis County, there's about 980,000 acres of tax forfeit land that is owned by the state. So we are like overly blessed and have an abundance of state, federal, and tribal and county lands. In fact, it's so much that in St. Louis County, which happens to be the lowest
amount of those types of lands that are in our Sandra Bach and my legislative district. St. Louis County has 61% of all the land in the county is publicly owned. Now, that sounds like a lot, doesn't it? But in neighboring Lake County, it's 80%, and in neighboring Cook County, it's 91%. So let's just take a run backwards and doing the math. So when St. Louis County does their budget, they are only hitting on 4 out of 10 cylinders in their car. I mean, 6 out of 10 cylinders, because they're on 60% of what they... I'm sorry, I got it screwed up. They're running on 4 of 10. They only got 40% of the land attached to run a county. In Lake County, it's 20%. In Cook County, it's 9%. Now, think about that in terms of your home budget, that tonight you go home, you find out that you only have 39% of your property, your wealth coming in this year for the salary, or 40% in the case of St. Louis County. And this is really serious business. And so this park, although wonderful as it is, causes a perplexing problem for Senator Bach and myself and the county. Firstly, we have never, in my legislative tenure here, which certainly isn't as long as Senator Bach, ever added to a state park without concurrence from the county government, whether it be Lake Cook or St. Louis. And we have added a lot of state land to state parks in the 6 years I've been here, and a lot more since 1994 when Senator Bach came. So one of the things that we said at the very outset when Commissioner Holson came to us and said we want to have a state park up there, and on this is the land, we need to have concurrence with the county. The county needs to pass a resolution in support of this. Another thing we said is, because of the situation where we have 60% land owned publicly already in the county, is that we need to have an offset, so that as this land is taken off the tax rolls and becomes public for a state park, that we have other lands that is owned by the state that will then be put on the tax rolls. And that way we don't further damage the ability of those taxpayers in those communities to be able to live and survive and provide the necessary services that are required and actually gotten by every county. Now, let's put it in perspective. Hennepin County has less than 1%, as I understand it, in public land. But my counties have 60, 80, and 90% in public land. So, I mean, we're doing it. This is a great benefit to the state. And we have all this recreational land that's available for hunting and fishing and hiking and camping and wilderness experience and all of that. But we still have to pay the bill. So, in our support for this park, this bill, as amended before you today, does a couple of things. The first item in Subdivision 4, and so if you look at the amendment, the 33A1 amendment, in Subdivision 4, it requires that within 24 months of the acquisition of the land for the state park, that with approval of the Land Exchange Board, that the state shall exchange lands that are school trusts or the lands that are in within the boundaries of the park, the proposed park, and that the lands that are within the boundaries of the park will be designated as school trust land. So we don't have any decrease in the amount of school trust land, and we keep the trust whole, and that those lands are then conveyed to the county so that then they can do as they wish with them, which could include selling them so that they're back on the tax rolls. It also says that the fees collected in the state for state permits and special state park use permits shall be deposited in the school trust fund. So what we'll have is a park that is benefits to the school kids in the state from the net proceeds of that operation. Which certainly, knowing that we've done a real... that in some instances we've done a poor job of managing some of the land. In fact, 92,000 acres of the land has no management. That's within the boundary waters. We get nothing off of that, but yet the Constitution says we must get revenue. We must maximize our revenue from school trust land, mining, logging, leasing, whatever it may be. And the lands that we're proposing to exchange, the lands that would lay on numerous lakes across St. Louis County, are getting no revenue. They're not leased, they're not mined, they're not timbered by and large.
And so really, we see this as a win-win for the school kids. We see this as a win-win for the people in the state. And we see this as a good arrangement for the county. And so that's the reason that the amendment and the bill is moving forward as it is. And I don't want anyone to think that this park isn't valuable, because the estimates have ranged anywhere from 10 to over $20 million for the value of this land. I think the county has it valued right now at about $13 million. And Commissioner Nelson is here to talk about some of these things. So that's the basic outline. That's the basic dilemma that we face in our communities in the north. And so I'd like to have, if we could, Commissioner Nelson come forward and add his thoughts and ideas to this. Commissioner Nelson, by the way, members, is the just retired board chair of the St. Louis County Board. And I'm certain that he will describe the significance of St. Louis County in terms of the state and its size and all of the things that they're facing as they operate on only 40% of the possible land within the county from which they raise their income.
Well, welcome, Commissioner Nelson. Thanks for your long wait. I hope you're not traveling back tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I've actually had a great deal of time to alter my comments and shorten them up considerably as I have been waiting, and I would start it off with good evening to this committee. My name is Keith Nelson. I am the past chair of the St. Louis County Board. I am currently the chair of Finance and Budget for the St. Louis County Board. Thank you, Representative Dills, for framing this issue. And they say the greatest form of flattery is being plagiarized. So I will thank Representative Dills for my comment, which is really concerning to me as a county commissioner in my third term. It is important to me as we take their directives as an arm of the state government, as we take their directives and provide those critical services in our community, that we have the ability, knowing that the only way that we can for resources for St. Louis County is property taxes, that we can maintain that ability to do so. I represent approximately 30,000 people in my district. There are seven districts in St. Louis County. We have the distinction of being the largest county in the state of Minnesota, with 3,000 miles of roads, over 1,000 bridges. We understand what it is to maintain infrastructure. We understand what it is to deliver services to our constituencies. And it is truly an honor and a privilege as a St. Louis County board member and as a citizen of St. Louis County to host the number of state parks and the number of tourists that we host from the metropolitan area, indeed from all of the state of Minnesota. I really consider that a privilege. But as we work towards these issues, and we want to be supportive of this state park, we think it's a tremendous resource, truly an invaluable addition to the state park system. We are only asking that in this exchange that we in St. Louis County, where 39% of our property is taxable property, is not owned by the government. 20% of the property in St. Louis County is federal. 40% of the property in St. Louis County belongs to the state, 20% of which we manage as tax forfeited land. As we take on that task, we also can narrow those numbers down even further. 90% of the property taxes in St. Louis County is generated on approximately 15% of the land. And so when we look at a development like what has been is being worked on, and in fact is in its final stages of being worked on by U.S. Steel, and I do have a handout for the committee. that really frames the issue that St. Louis County, using very, very conservative figures, will lose approximately $1 million in property taxes if this development does not occur. So this type of an exchange, which would afford us the opportunity to continue to provide the services that our legislature and our federal government asks us to make certain that we provide, this type of exchange really would help ensure that St. Louis County, its taxpayers, and those people that we serve are made whole in this process. And for that, I would really thank you for your consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members.
Commissioner Nelson, and I certainly understand the concerns about the property tax rates and the loss of property tax base. I represent a county that actually has the highest property tax rates in the state, and it's a county that also has a significant amount of land that's not on the property tax rolls. Just wondering where your county ranks. I don't know if you know what the rank is. I assume that the property tax rates are quite high, and where they would rank among the other counties.
Well, I can't give you an accurate reflection of where we rank with other counties. That's above my pay grade. I worry about St. Louis County and how we manage that and how we scrutinize every dollar that goes out the door. But I would only say this, that our abilities are really encumbered by the fact that we have such a small amount of properties that really makes up the baseline or the pool from which we can draw. And that has really become a critical issue for us, not only in the sense that again, like I said, the 30% versus or 39% versus 61% government ownership, but also in developable properties. St. Louis County has the distinction of having over 90% of our pre-settlement wetlands still intact, and that's an important component. That in St. Louis County that we respect tremendously. And so when we look at these lands, whether they would be used for forestry practices, these exchange lands, or whether they would be utilized in a development type of scenario to put them back on the tax rolls, we will be extremely sensitive that only those highland areas, those areas that are suitable for that type of development, are utilized, because, again, over 90% of our pre-settlement wetlands are still in existence.
And any other questions, Commissioner Nelson?
You know, I do have a question.
Ms. Galvey.
Thank you. Regarding the lands that you're proposing to trade, is Lakeshore property, you're saying, and is it state-owned? Maybe Representative Deal would be better to answer this, because I'm kind of wondering if those aren't exquisite, unique lands, and so the state then would be exchanging those lands for the Vermilion Park, and I'm wondering what difference will it make to the state if those lands would be lost?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scalzi, in the bill it talks about I'm trying to find it here. On line 1.9, it says an equal shoreline footage and not located within the boundary line. First thing, we got 92,000 acres of ultra-exclusive and exquisite land in the boundary waters that belongs to the school trust that's available for any Minnesotan to use at their will. That's just even more exclusive than the land that is on Lake Vermilion. And we're charged with trying to maximize the benefit to the school kids of that land. We get nothing from it, essentially nothing. There is an abundance, as you may know, up in northern Minnesota when the land was granted to the state, because there weren't lands, and actually Director Vadas could explain this more accurately, but we got double stroked up there. Instead of just getting section 16, I think it was, we got section 16 and 36. So in every township, we got 2 square miles instead of 1 square mile. Mm-hmm. And that's very abundant in my legislative district. In fact, Director Vadas could tell us how many acres are outside the boundary waters, but in those counties. It's tens of thousands.
And some of them will be very prime shoreline. But we will be able to also pick from a variety of lakes and disperse any potential development to a variety, a number of lakes, so that it isn't a block, such as the Vermilion Land would be, you know, where you have thousands and thousands of shoreline feet contiguous. So, you know, some over here, some over here, some on this lake, some on that lake. So it is, in fact, state land, and it is going to be partially, at least an equal amount of shoreline. But it will be, you know, would be dramatically scattered around in St. Louis County, which there's an abundance of it. So I hope that answered your question.
Well, it did a little bit. Thank you, Representative Dill. I was just wondering, those scattered lots on these lakes, would that be, is there some reason that those are state land scattered on those lakes, and would the state be better off to sell those lands themselves individually rather than trade them for Lake Vermilion property?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, and Representative Scalzi, that we would be just thrilled to have the state sell that land themselves and get this over with. And because that would accomplish the goal, because then the county would have the land on the tax rolls. But so far, the administration has been unwilling to discuss that with us and unwilling to identify any land for that purpose. And so we are left to come here and with this approach. So I hope that answers your question. And I guess we're on questions of the commissioner.
Mr. Chair, committee members, the one thing that, at least from St. Louis County's perspective, that we would hope to accomplish in this, there are a number of fragmented parcels throughout St. Louis County, and the goals that we have had, and it's a goal shared by the DNR, is to consolidate those interests. From a management perspective, that is a tremendous efficiency for the taxpayers. So as we look at these lands and as we look at these different areas, there may be opportunities where we can, where private development is here and government lands are more grouped together. So we're trying to make certain that our management practices are conducive with the overall picture of not only health for our environment, but being able to maintain that tax base, etc.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment on that. We are constantly and forever, because of the patchwork of public land ownership in northern Minnesota, whether it be school trust, fee land, tax forfeit land, tribal land, county land, we are forever trying to find opportunities to consolidate lands for better management purposes. And, you know, we've had bills on that. In fact, we're having an expedited exchange bill here before the night's over, hopefully, that goes right to the root of that very problem. And so in thinking of this, in the scope of this land exchange, we would certainly expect that the department would think of lands that are next to county lands, as the commissioner had suggested, and that those would be ones that would be targeted. Now, we also said that this needs to be on an ad valorem basis. So we also might be willing to exchange lands that aren't lakeshore as well for forestry lands or other lands of value. So, I mean, we're not talking exclusively lakeshore property here. So I'm hoping you're getting a feel for how we're envisioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee member.
Here, I'd like to add something else. I think Mr. Meyer's coming up here.
Okay.
One of the things I've learned over 6 years of serving on this committee, as well as Representative Bogini of this committee, and learned just recently by attending the LCMR hearing on this very park, that we are forever totally consumed with deferred maintenance in state parks. In fact, I think the number is nearly $110 or $120 million in deferred maintenance, which we have hopelessly dealt with over the past, in my tenure here at the legislature. We have nickeled and dimed our way to this huge, unsurmountable number of deferred maintenance. With my proposal, you're not going to have any deferred maintenance, because when the receipts from the park are given to the school trust, you'll have your management and all of your maintenance costs taken out before they are given to the school trust to be used for the benefit of the students. So when we face this problem on an ongoing basis with this huge $100-plus million problem, the way this is designed, we aren't going to have that problem, because the way the DNR manages school trust lands is that they manage the land, they get the income from the land, and then they certify their costs for management and maintenance of roads, all of the things that they do, and they deduct that from the proceeds from the leases and the mining and the royalties and the timber, and then the school trust gets the balance. So this is one of the beauties of this proposal, is that we won't have to face that problem in the future.
And Mr. Meyer, thanks for coming. Maybe you could address the issue as far as the costs of operating the park, how much could be covered under the revenue that's generated by a park of that nature. Of course, it might be hard to anticipate. It depends on what kind of park and what kind of, obviously, attendance that it receives. But
Mr. Chair, members, and I do have Director Clinton Nelson from our parks here to talk about some projections on that side of it, and also Director Nelson, or Marty Vadas, talk about the difficulties and the timeline and cost of exchanging the land. But I just want to make a couple of general comments first. First of all, I want to thank Representative Dill for bringing this bill before us the way it was introduced initially.
For
sure. And I want to thank St. Louis County for their support, not only for hosting all the parks that we have, but also their willingness to continue to talk with us about the establishment of this new park. And also thank the House Environment Finance Committee and Bonding Committee for the $15.5 million that are currently in the House bonding proposal. As to the amendment, Mr. Chair, we do have some drastic concerns about it. First of all, we just finished exchanging all the school trust lands out of the park system. So for us to put this many more acres back in, we do not believe it's the right direction to go. I do appreciate the comments that Representative Dill raised about the fees. However, the language in the amendment, I don't think, does that. And we would have to create a different type of suspense account, because we only have the suspense authority for the forestry-related costs. And I just want to put on the record a couple things. This park, if acquired, will be a statewide asset. It will be a statewide park for everyone to enjoy. And we are going to work with St. Louis County to deal with those public-private land ownership issues. You may well be aware of the statewide land record system that we're currently in the process of developing, establishing a state-of-the-art lands record system, which will help us identify those fragmented lands and make sure that we can get those lands that should be protected on the public rolls or on the tax rolls again, that shouldn't be protected, that makes sense to sell, looking at ones that we should protect, and really further utilizing our land asset management strategy of the state. We cannot own every piece of land in the state. And it's as simple as that. For payments in lieu of taxes to what needs to be there, to county acceptance, it just doesn't make sense. But what we can do is develop tools, conservation easements, forest legacy is a prime example of that. We can look at how can we protect lands and how can we work together with those counties to protect lands. And we do want to work with St. Louis County to address the concerns that they have. However, Mr. Chair, members, we do feel strongly that this amendment at this time is not the right way to go.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. And Representative,
you know, we haven't been to a finance committee and don't have the fiscal note on this. But when I look at within 24 months of this acquisition, you're going to do all this. What would your estimate of cost be? You have that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Virginius, I'd like to bring up Marty Vadas, and he can discuss those. If you don't, if there's any questions for me, I'll just kind of refer to Director Vadas and Director Nelson. I think the questions might be on those operating costs in the park, but I do want to say thank you to everybody for your strong support on this issue.
Mr. Chair, while Mr. Vadas is coming up, and we're talking, he is extremely knowledgeable on this. And I'd even have a few questions myself about my own district, because he knows the answers. But in terms of the bill, we've got quite a few stops to make. And if we don't, if there's a problem with the suspense account that Mr. Meyer suggested, we can certainly fix that along the way. We want to make sure this is done right. We want to make sure we benefit the kids with this park. I mean, if that's the direction we're going to go. And I can understand why the park department doesn't want to get lose control of this, because this is going to be a real money maker. I mean, they're going to have 400,000 visitors they're going to be talking about here, and they're going to have people coming and paying fees, and they're going to use that money to maintain other parks.
And really, what we're trying to do is have a park for the entire state and to help the kids. I mean, I thought that was our number one priority in the DFL caucus was education. So with that, I'd like to thank the chair for his indulgence.
Mr. Vadas, welcome. Just taking that for the record.
My name is Marty Vadas, and I'm the director of the Lands and Minerals Division for DNR. And I believe Representative Wagenius' question related to the fiscal impact of an exchange that's proposed in the bill. Is that the question?
Well, I had several, and that would be a good start.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think probably the exchange that would be the most similar to the one that's being contemplated in this bill would be that exchange that Commissioner Meyer talked about, getting the school trust fund land out of state parks. And last biennium, when we started the biennium, there was about 4,600 acres of trust land in state parks. And it took us one biennium, 2 years, to exchange that out for other DNR-owned lands outside of state parks. And so that took us 2 years. And that was probably one FTE staff time for that two-year period to accomplish that. And the major cost associated with that would be the appraisals. And I don't recall the precise number, but my memory is it was something on the order of $50,000 or $60,000 to have appraisals done on the land to ensure that it was value for value.
I think there's just some basic questions here that, and I know you all aren't given an opportunity to testify, and I think actually that would be better. I know Mr. Meyer gave us a little bit of overview, but I have heard all sorts of numbers thrown around about, or I shouldn't say thrown around, I've heard all sorts of numbers used about the cost to develop this park. And so when I hear about those numbers and then to see that all the fees would be put in the school trust land, I reflect and wonder whether it wouldn't be just better to put a certain dollar amount into the school trust land directly rather than moving lands around and then having a fairly contentious. Why would we put a whole bunch of money into the park if we're not going to have the money to pay for it? So, with that, maybe you can just comment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think the question is on just compensating that trust fund and transferring ownership of the land. And if it's a sale or exchange of the trust fund land, that really has to be on a value-for-value basis. So I suppose, in theory, what you're suggesting could be a way to compensate the trust fund for the value of the land at the time that the transfer is made. School trust fund land, there are 2.5 million acres in Minnesota, and it is for the purpose of generating income for the school trust fund. So things like sale of timber and sale of mineral rights are the major sources of generating income. Once the land is sold, the ability to generate income is gone. And so in DNR, we tend not to gravitate towards selling those lands because really then eliminate any kind of revenue generation in the future off those lands. So often it's not our preferred direction to sell those lands. Exchanging them is preferable. So you can continue.
Mr. Chairman? That's one bill.
Well, thank you. And Director Vadas, Representative Scalzi's question. About just within a gunshot here, about how many acres of school trust are in St. Louis County?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, there are 482,000 acres in St. Louis County.
480, so that would be 150 times the number of acres that we're getting in the Vermilion State Park, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Mr. Chair, I can't do the arithmetic then.
Well, 115 times 3 is 45, so that's 450,000. So there's 15 times just in St. Louis County alone of the number of school acres, trust acres that are being established and that would be established under this bill.
So what the point is I'm making, Representative Scully, just to follow up on your question, is that there's an abundance of opportunity in St. Louis County alone of the 2.2 million acres of school trust in Minnesota. There's 450,000 in just one county. So I mean, there's an abundance of opportunity for this type of activity, and as well, Mr. Chairman, if Commissioner Nelson could come back up, and I don't think you should leave either. I think you're gonna. There's more questions. I was talking about Commissioner Nelson from St. Louis County, not Gordon. All right. And you know, another thing, members, is this isn't a precedent setting. This isn't a precedent setting thing that I'm proposing, and Senator Bach has already passed out of this very committee. And on to further committees over in the Senate. Commissioner Nelson, could you explain to us how this isn't precedent setting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fields, and I apologize, in my condensed version, and I was doing my best to condense it, one of the points that I think is very
critical in this
is that just in the past 10 years, St. Louis County worked with the DNR to exercise this very same type of exchange to get the DNR out of the shoreland leases within the borders of St. Louis County. In fact, we exchanged roughly 5 acres for every acre that we got back that was on shoreland. So we've been through this in reverse, where we worked with the DNR to accomplish for them this same type of a land exchange that now we are asking the DNR to reciprocate and do a similar type of exchange to keep us whole as far as our property taxes.
I think the added interest here is that you make the exchange and then the state pays to develop the park, but the fees at some Mr. Vadas hasn't yet told us what we're talking about for development, but then all the fees from the park go to the school trust land. I don't think that is not a precedent that I've heard about. So that was not part of the St. Louis County stuff, was it? Build the park there and then have the fees from the park go into the school trust land?
Mr. Chair, Representative, again, you're getting above my pay grade on that one.
Okay.
I would only trust you that the importance from St. Louis County standpoint is that we retain our ability to continue to manage in accordance with your directive. So that is the key for us. When you had 5 and 6 and 7 zeros behind it, I start losing a little bit of track on those things. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Dale. Director Data testified a few moments ago about the cost of the exchange to Representative Genius's question. Frankly, I think it's going to cost more than that. More than, you said, $50,000, I think. I think it'll cost more than that. But, I mean, you're talking...
Yeah.
board member of the Minnesota Nordic Ski Association, and a group that very strongly supports the establishment of Lake Vermilion State Park. And we also really do appreciate Representative Bill brought this issue forward, and it can be processed. I had forgotten how long in the evenings these committee meetings can go, and I had been scribbling out things like mad as they've been said or otherwise perhaps not needed. So I'm going to do my best to be very, very quickly, or do this very quickly. Representative Deal put it very, very well
in his opening comments. This really is a spectacular place, and I had planned to elaborate on that, but I won't. That was well said. I'd like to pose a little bit different issue before you and just create the question, would such a park fill any kind of need? I mean, are we really talking about something that we need? And I think the answer is absolutely a resounding yes for a number of reasons. The first is our population is projected to increase by 27% in the next 30 years. And does anybody in this room think it's going to stop growing then? It almost certainly will continue beyond that. We have a Minnesota State Park System land study that projected recreation demand for the year 2025 in the Lake Vermilion area is going to be very high, as it is for all of our lake districts, in fact. We have over 11,000 lakes in Minnesota, and while we've done a pretty respectable job establishing public boat ramps and so forth on our lakes, only 30 of our state parks, well scattered around the state, and a number of them actually quite polluted, offer the public camping, fishing, and swimming opportunities that make up that special place of the lake experience. Not long ago, Minnesota families of modest means, and by that I mean most of us, could spend time getting that lake experience at one of the many small mom-and-pop resorts that actually were quite affordable. Those days, we all know, are gone forever. The resorts essentially have disappeared. Sold to developers. Or such families could have purchased their own small lake lot, built a modest cabin, and enjoyed time up at the lake. But no longer. The prohibitively high and rising price of lakeshore, the associated escalating property taxes are rapidly preventing that average Jane and Joe from any such experience. What irony. Minnesotans progressively shut out of the Minnesota iconic experience. Not long ago, such access was understood to be almost a Minnesotan's birthright. We do have concerns about the land exchange provisions, the school trust fund, and so forth that's been mentioned before. I do acknowledge, however, for heaven's sake, there really is a property tax issue, and there's no question about that. And I'm really hoping that there can be some other method that can be found to address the legitimate concerns that folks have in St. Louis County and certainly Representative Bill's district. That, again, as Judy said, we've got creative minds and we can hopefully resolve that issue. Let me end with something that really strikes the emotions for me about this issue of parks. 117 years ago, legislators established Itasca State Park, and they did it with not a single vote to spare. One more no vote, we don't have Itasca State Park. What an incredible debt we owe those folks for their foresight and also their courage. Times were not great to establish a park back in 1891. Can we too leave such a flagship park legacy for Minnesotans long after we're gone? We'll never have a better chance. It would be really sad to let this opportunity slip. It would be really sad to let this opportunity slip away. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Nelson? Seeing none.
That's encouraging. I'm ready to take a vote, and I just want to make one more statement about this bill. The original bill was not as it is today with the amendment. The state has 480,000 acres in school trust land, 980,000 in tax forfeit land,
another slew of tens and tens and tens of thousands of acres of fee land and acquired land in St. Louis County. And all we asked for was that we make a trade for equal value in the original bill. And no one has come to the table and said that, at least at the department or the administration, let's say, and said, this is something we'll contemplate. So, personally, I'd be more than happy to forget the school trust idea if we could just get them to come to the table and talk turkey over something that's absolutely reasonable. You've heard everybody, you've heard the commissioner say, the commissioner doesn't care if he gets school trust lands, he wants lands of equal value so that we don't damage our tax base. That's all we're really asking for. And so to put us in a position to really be able to negotiate, we had to go way to the left or right, or however you want to frame it, of where we need to be. So I'm asking that you vote this through, knowing that I want to get into a negotiation with the department and do what's right for the state and create this state park that I strongly support, that we do what's right for St. Louis County and the taxpayers in that county, and do it in a way that can at least bring some peace in the valley, and you can mark that off the bingo list, and a win-win. And come up with an outcome that's good for Minnesota. How's that on the bingo? How's that, Jane? So with that, that's we're ready.
We need to use all the tools in the toolbox.
So in order to do this at this late deadline, we have to advance the bill.
Any comments? I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
President Dill renews his motion that House Bill 3433, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion fails.
Oh, I'm on the division.
Division has been called. All those in favor signify by raising your hands. All those opposed? Motion fails and a vote of 6-6. Okay, we do have another bill for Representative Dill. House File 3280. If you would like to move that, please.
Negotiating position.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I move House File 3280, bring it before the committee, and like Ms. Lewis to come up and explain the bill, please.
Sure. Representative Lodinius.
What's the compared to what we've heard before?
The bill that you just voted down.
No.
Yeah, exactly the same, no changes.
It's because I don't see an appeals thing in here.
I guess the committee engrossment was not placed in the folder.
Yes, we are gonna make a change. I'm sorry. I'm still wrapped up in the other bill.
Okay.
Ms. Lewis, which of the sections do we want to delete in an amendment or an oral amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Kathy Lewis of the Department of Natural Resources, BNR. House File 3280 has been amended previously in committee, and Section 2 was added to the bill, which you saw earlier last week. And at that point in time, Representative Lewis raised the issue about the district court, and the bill was referred to the Committee on Public Safety. They have now kicked it back. And what we're proposing is that we delete Section 2 from the bill. This is where the Representative Guinness had the questions originally.
Does that work for you?
Yes, but it's not in here.
I don't see it in here. Now I'm looking at it. Let's see it.
That's what it's going to be all over.
So I'm not sure how that...
Because it was appealed.
I guess we can get a copy of the...
I don't necessarily need a copy, but I think we just need to be clear of what's happening, because this is not what we've seen before. That's... I don't... if we could have the... Other people might need to see it, but I don't.
Yeah,
I just want to be clear.
Not the same building.
So then, have to change. The bill before us is identical, except that Section 2 was deleted.
Mr. Chair, Representative Deal, that is correct. The bill reads as the department would like to see it to read.
Okay. So what my motion should be that House File 3280 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Yeah, and be brought back for reconsideration.
Okay. So we need to reconsider on House File 3280?
Right. So we would move to have the first committee in Grossman reconsidered and brought before the committee for further action.
Okay. That's be my motion.
Okay. So we will then have a discussion if anybody has any questions or anybody understands the change. Leading Section 2.
We're voting on
the reconsideration.
You have to adopt that change. We will vote to reconsider. All those in favor of reconsideration signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is now before us. And we will have to act on the change then to amend, to delete Section 2. From the first committee in Grossman. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
So now, Mr. Chair, the bill is amended, correct?
Right. So we will, if there's first any further discussion. Okay. Seeing none, and Representative Dell renews his motion that House File 3280, First Committee Engrossment, be recommended to pass. And we referred to the General Register.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed the General Register. And that is the last bill for tonight.
Already?
We'll see you on Thursday.